It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson up the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
Is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you've got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
Scott Rintoul with you. We'll get you through this morning. We'll make it better for you. That's our pledge every single day. And we'll do that for you this Tuesday. Lots going on in the sports world. Lots going on in hockey, and not all of it the type of stuff people want to consume right now. But as we talked about last week, and as we've mentioned over the course of the weekend and early this week, this is going to continue for a while. There are going to be more stories that come out, and there are going to be strange twists and turns in some of these stories. And you may not know everything when some of the stories about hockey culture come out, about certain coaches come out, about certain players come out. You might not know everything, and you're going to have to be willing to listen to see where it goes, because some of the transgressions are going to be worse than others, and you'll have to decide for yourself where you sit on some of them. Sean Avery story, for example, as it relates to Mark Crawford, that has taken an interesting twist in the last 24 hours. And then there's the Mike Babcock situation. And it does feel like the Mike Babcock stories are going to keep coming. Maybe I'm overblowing it, but every couple of days, something else trickles out. The latest revelations about Johan Franzen, those are difficult ones to hear. Franzen reveals the negative impact on his life that Mike Babcock had, and the emotional slash mental abuse, that's how many are characterizing the way he berated him and some of the things that were said to him on that Detroit Red Wings bench. When a guy like Chris Chelios comes out and shares stories, it's going to get some traction. And there has not been a response from Mike Babcock to this point in time. But watching Johan Franzen, even if you didn't understand the language, which was translated because it was done in Swedish, and the article was translated to English, and you see some of the reactions from him on video, even if you don't understand the language, where he is sobbing, he is crying, he has gone through a lot in his life, and it's not all from Mike Babcock, but there was a piling on component here. And I do think when it comes to a guy like Johan Franzen making these allegations, it's important to point out who we're talking about here, because I do think there's an eye roll from some people when we go down this road right now. I think there are some who say, another story about a coach, another Mike Babcock story. Remember the context. Guys like Chris Chelios. Chris Chelios, a Hall of Fame player. Chris Chelios played till he was 48. Chris Chelios is a guy who, during the course of his career, rocked the foundation at times, and during the course of that interview, Spittin' Chiclets on the weekend did the same when it came to Mike Babcock. And with Johan Franzen, important to point out that Franzen was never a guy. Those of you who watched him play, and I assume that's the majority of you, those of you who watched Johan Franzen play like I did know that he never has been, never will be confused for a player who was not willing to pay the price. They called him the mule for a reason. He was stubborn. He was persistent. He was impossible to move from the edge of the blue paint. That's where he set up shop, and he took the physical punishment and dished it out at times. So I don't want to hear any of the "this guy can't take it." I don't want to hear any of that. These are stories that are being shared. Todd Bertuzzi was on the airwaves this morning and said, "I'm not sure we should be critical. I don't think we should be critical of guys who choose to share their stories and the guys who choose not to. It's everybody's decision." You've heard that a lot over the course of the last week or 10 days. Mitch Marner said something to similar effect in Toronto last week. It's your voice. You choose how to use it. It does lead to a couple of bigger conversations, specifically with Babcock. How do we view his legacy? How is it different? How will it shape the way we think about Mike Babcock? I'm not sure we have an answer to that question yet, but we are talking about a coach who was viewed as the no-brainer, head of the class in his field for a considerable length of time. likely a Hall of Famer, and his reputation has been altered significantly already. It may continue to erode. We're not sure exactly where this is going. The other conversation it brings up, and I want your feedback on this, because I do believe it changes over time. As you mature, it changes. Some people may say it doesn't, and some people draw a different line. But how much do you care about the person you cheer for as opposed to the job that person does? I think it's something all of us as fans weigh. As you get older, I think that changes. When you are a kid, when you are impressionable, all you see is what happens on the ice, what happens on the field, the number of baskets a player scores, the highlight reel stuff. And that's what originally attracts you to a player. Or maybe it's the heart and soul player that ends up being your favorite. But you only worry about what that player does for your team in those moments. And there is an assumption in sports, and Jeff Blair just wrote a very good article about this. There's an assumption in sports that is categorically incorrect. Categorically incorrect. But there's an assumption that they're all good guys. Well, whether you're in your workplace, teams you've played for, places you've been in your life, we all know that there are some people who are not great. We're all flawed. We all make mistakes. But there are some people who continue to act in a behavior that you really don't want anything to do with. We don't know that about a lot of the players or coaches that we support or cheer for. We don't know that. And some people don't want to know. But how has that changed for you as you've gotten older? And there are different standards that we hold coaches to as opposed to players. And it makes sense to me. Take hockey, for example. I've used the parent-child analogy a lot because I do think it's fitting. The parent has to be the more responsible party. The child is going to make mistakes out of ignorance. And in the case of a player, they are going to make some mistakes on the ice. They are going to cross the lines at times in hockey because we ask them to live on the edge. That's where we ask them to live, to play the game that we love to watch, we love to consume, and has a physical element to it. We ask them to skate as close to that edge as possible and don't go over. So there has to be an allowance when they do to a certain degree. There are some things that are leaps and bounds across that line that you draw, but there is an allowance. There is a gray area just past that line where you say, oh, I understand how that happened. We're asking this person to do something that in normal society would put you in jail. But we're asking them to do that on a nightly basis, and we're paying them handsomely for it. And they are there for our entertainment to go as close to that line as possible. That's what we want from them. So sometimes they are going to go over the line. The coaches, while they're not involved to that level, and while it's an intense environment, we ask them to be the responsible adult. And so, yes, they are held to a higher standard. But where has that changed for you? How has it changed for you? There are ugly allegations that come out against players in every sport. There are some tough ones that have come out against coaches in hockey recently, against players in hockey as well. So how has that changed for you? How has the standard changed? How has the way you view athletes changed? Hit me up. You've got the text message inbox. You've got the fan feedback line. I want to see what you get, or where you're at, I should say. We're getting a lot right now. I'm going to have to edit some of these on the fly because of the language, but I will get to them. I promise you that. Scott Rintoul with you. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. The big game of the night, with all due respect to what was going on in the National Hockey League, and by the way, in the National Hockey League, Vegas won last night, Anaheim won last night. You keep looking at those Pacific Division standings, they're pretty tight, and this is how it's going to be for quite some time. But last night, Seattle Seahawks, what do they do? What they do best. They get the job done. There is exactly one win for the Seattle Seahawks this year. One out of 10. They're 10-2, and they have one win that qualifies as relatively easy. In week 4, the Hawks beat Arizona 27-10. Their 9 other wins are by one score. They're within one score. They play close games. They live dangerously, and they like living dangerously. Listen to Pete Carroll after the game last night. He loves this.
Close games are cool, aren't they? Yeah. I don't know. I like them. Maybe the 17 points was too much. I don't know. We shouldn't have been hit by that much. I don't know.
He's joking, of course. The 17 points was too much. They had a 17-point bulge, 34-17 in the fourth quarter. He's joking, but he's kind of not. Pete Carroll would much rather play in a one-score game than one in which his team rolls and they're up 45-10 and it's garbage time and Russell Wilson's out and guys who are just getting special teams duty for the most part are getting meaningful reps on offense and defense. Pete Carroll likes to live that way. He loves it. He believes that is what builds champions because those are what playoff games are made of, so that you're not uneducated about the moment, that you've lived there before. And this pressure that you feel in the fourth quarter when games are on the line, it's nothing new. That's what he believes. Difficult to argue with his track record. Difficult to argue with that track record for Russell Wilson as well. Because the Seahawks, at their core, believe two things. And I'm talking the decision makers there. I'm sure there's players on the team that would much rather be up by that type of margin I talked about. But the Seahawks like to live with the slimmest of margins in Pete Carroll's mantra, because they believe two things. They believe that over four quarters, they are going to wear you down. And then the other thing they believe is that Russell Wilson will make plays when he has to. He didn't have to make that many last night. The first one took effect. They wore down the Vikings over four quarters. The running game took over. It was great for them last night, the two-headed monster of Chris Carson and Rashad Penny. And let's be clear, that game changed dramatically when Dalvin Cook fumbled the football. It only amounted in 3 points for the Seahawks at the time, but Cook left the game. It changed the dynamic. Alexander Mattison's, he's a nice backup. He's a nice rookie. He had some productive moments, but the focal point of the offense changes dramatically when Dalvin Cook is not a part of it. The Seahawks love to live there. And as mentioned, it's difficult to argue with their track record, and they are great in the tight margins this year. They're 10-2, and only one of those games has been relatively easy as far as winning it goes. 9-1 in one-score games this year. But let's be clear about one thing as well on the other side. While Russell Wilson last night moved to the greatest Monday Night Football record of all time, he has the greatest winning percentage. He passed Randall Cunningham. He's 9-2 on Monday nights. It's an incredible statistic for a guy that I still think is somehow underrated by many people in the football world. Kirk Cousins is 0-8 now. He's the GOAT in that respect, the way we used to use GOAT. He's had the GOAT horns on Monday night. He's lost his first 8 Monday night football starts. But also, let's be clear about one thing. Kirk Cousins didn't cost the Vikings that game last night. He didn't fumble the ball. I just mentioned Dalvin Cook did that. He didn't drop a pass into a waiting DB's arms. That pass to Stephon Diggs with a good pass hit Stephon Diggs in the hands. Stephon Diggs needs to make that catch. Instead, it's an interception. A few plays later, it's in the end zone. But here's why you're down on Kirk Cousins, if you're a Vikings fan, if you're a fan of football. Because despite all of the Vikings' misgivings in the second half, despite the fact they were down 17 points, Kirk Cousins got the ball back in the final 5 minutes, and he had a chance to win the game. And he didn't do it. It's not that Kirk Cousins is incapable. He has the tools, but he's just not going to find a way like Russell Wilson does in those moments most times, because he's not a top-tier quarterback. Does that mean you cannot win with Kirk Cousins? No, I believe that you can win with a Kirk Cousins. This conversation can be extended to a Jimmy Garoppolo in San Francisco. Well, in the big moments, is Jimmy going to get it done? Well, he's not going to get it done as often as Tom Brady. He's not going to get it done as often as Russell Wilson, Patrick Mahomes. But that doesn't mean he can't get it done. It means you have to have pieces in place around them. And that'll be the bigger conversation about Minnesota, because you know what Kirk Cousins is at this point, just like you know what Russell Wilson is at this point. Russell Wilson needs less around him than Kirk Cousins does if he's going to win football games. It sounds obvious, but why are people so down on Kirk Cousins? Do they think he's all of a sudden going to become a top-tier quarterback? Do they think he's in that echelon of player? At his best, Kirk Cousins is going to move up to that second tier, one of the first few guys you think of. Maybe the first guy you think. That's Kirk Cousins at his best. He can get the job done. You just need some pieces around him. So let's not everybody say, well, they lost that game because of Kirk Cousins. No. They lost that game because they lost a couple of pieces around Kirk Cousins, and you know exactly what he is. And yet somehow they were right there at the end, because the Seahawks love to play this way, and there are flaws within the Seahawks, something we can get into throughout the rest of the show. We do this every Tuesday. We call it Top 5 Tuesday. We got an interesting list for you today that I want you to weigh in on.
Counting down the best, the worst, and everything else. It's time for Top 5 Tuesday.
So tonight in Vancouver, Alex Burrows is going to be honored by the Vancouver Canucks. They have a Ring of Honor. He is going to go into the Ring of Honor. He's going to be the seventh member of the Ring of Honor. He's going to join the likes of Thomas Gradin and Kirk McLean and Matthias Olin. They're going to feed him tonight in Vancouver. And Alex Burrows, if you are a Canucks fan, is beloved. This market loves Alex Burrows, but other markets, not so much. They couldn't stand Alex Burrows. Didn't want anything to do with them. So Alex Burrows is the inspiration for today's list. And the list is this. You'd love him if you had him. Not so much if you don't, but you'd love him if you had him. And I'm going to give you the five players in the National Hockey League right now that you would love if you had, but probably can't stand because you don't. And surprisingly, number five on the list happens to be a current member of the Vancouver Canucks.
Yanni Gourde got run into the curved glass of the bench. He comes after Roussel, and they're going to go at it. And Roussel gets the upper hand early.
Oh, yeah, he jumped on him real fast. That's what he does. When he decides to get involved, he'll go right at you.
Antoine Roussel, one of those guys who will cross the line, one of those guys who will do anything to win. Antoine Roussel, much in the same vein as Alex Burrows, there's more there skill set-wise than probably you thought at the beginning. But he's one of those guys that if he is not on your team, you cannot stand. He's a burr in the saddle for every team he plays against, and he makes no bones about it. He's okay playing that role. Now, he can play last year in Vancouver at times in the top six. On a really good team, he's probably a bottom six guy. But Antoine Roussel, one of those players willing to assume the role and not exactly endearing himself to other fan bases. Again, if you have guys that you think should be on this list, and I think you know where this list is headed, I think you know who's at the top of it, but send in your submissions. You've got the text message inbox. You've got the fan feedback line. Number four on this list, Drew Doughty. Now, not everybody dislikes Drew Doughty, but he's a guy who doesn't mind taking shots at other players. He doesn't mind taking shots at other fan bases. He's willing to play the villain card. He's willing to embrace it. What he and Matthew Tkachuk have going on right now is special. It's unique, and we all revel at it. But Drew Doughty, a lot of fan bases are down on him. They don't like hearing from him. They think he talks too much for perhaps the game he brings. We're talking about a Norris Trophy winning defenseman. And I think people confuse sometimes the fact that they don't like Drew Doughty and they don't like the things Drew Doughty says with his ability to play the game. Is he at his peak right now? Probably not, but he's a very good player and you would love to have him on your blue line. But if you don't have him on your blue line, you can't stand him being on the team that you are playing that night in the LA Kings. And as mentioned, what goes on between him and Tkachuk and Flames fans and other fan bases, this is a guy who took shots at fellow blue liners last year, guys like Brent Burns. Now he doesn't play defense. Was very complimentary of Mark Giordano when he was making that comment. But he doesn't pull a lot of punches in the media. And he is on this list at number four. Number three, changed places in the offseason. And I think once we get to playoff time, people will remember exactly why this guy is number three on the list.
Henry forechecking, and he accepted his revenge against Weber. And now Jake Gardner comes in, and he's got to be careful. Jordy Benn takes him. You could tell from the moment that he got back up that Nazem Kadri was mad and he was going to get somebody.
That's Nazem Kadri for you. He will cross that line. He has been suspended in two consecutive playoff series as a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs. He had a hit that went unpenalized by the league on Daniel Sedin that should have been a suspension earlier in his career. Really good player. Really good player. We're talking about your prototypical second-line center in the National Hockey League and a guy that, like Ryan Kessler, when he was healthy and playing at his best, he can score for you, he can back-check for you, he can get under the skin of the opposition. He is a great hockey player. But if he's not on your team, he's one of those guys that's on the wanted poster. Can't stand him. Hope somebody rubs out Kadri tonight. He better not take any liberties with our players. Which is where our next guy comes in. The top two on this list were not hard to determine. Tom Wilson is number two. You know how good he is. You know how effective he is. And you also know there aren't many of him in the National Hockey League. He has crossed the line way too many times. Way too many times. And yet, is he not the epitome of you'd love him if you had him? There are teams actively trying to find guys like Tom Wilson. They can't, because not many guys like that exist. Sometimes it's difficult to separate the fact that Wilson crosses the line, as mentioned, more than he should, with the fact that he is a really good hockey player as well. He's a first-round draft pick. He's a guy who can put the puck in the net, and he helps give the Capitals that heavy persona. He's not the only one, but he's the most effective in doing it, especially when he's close to the line instead of going over the line. But Tom Wilson, you'd love him if you had him. You can't stand him if you don't, because generally he's doing something that crosses the line with one of your players, or at least that's the way it feels. Number one on this list is obvious, but he's there anyway. Play the highlight.
Dumba still tangled up behind the play with Marchand. And it looks like we're going to end up with penalties as the takedown occurs. Marchand still delivering a face wash. He's been known to blur some lines, to say the least.
As a teammate, you love it. Playing against him, it really does get under your skin.
Yeah, just a little. It gets under your skin. Sometimes it's licking your skin. That's what Brad Marchand does. He's at the top of the list. If he was on your team, you would live with it. You might not like all of the tactics. You may frown at them, but you would live with them, because we are talking about a guy who's a Hart Trophy candidate a lot of years, a lot of recent years. It's a guy who scored 100 points. He scored 100 points. And I will say Brad Marchand has toned down his act considerably in the last season and a half. That doesn't mean that he's always going to be a choir boy. It doesn't mean he's not going to put the skate over the line now and then, just to remind you that, oh yeah, I'm still Brad Marchand. But we're talking about a Hart Trophy candidate. We're talking about a guy who still finds a way to get under the skin of his opponents. He's at the top of this list. Somebody you think I missed? Somebody you want to nominate instead? Hit me up. You've got the text message inbox. You also have the fan feedback line. You'd love him if you had him, but you don't, so you can't stand him. That's the list we're rolling out today. How hot is it right now in Montreal? Sounds like a strange question to be asking in December, but Marc Bergevin, probably feeling a little different than most. Eric Engels joins us next to check in on the Canadiens on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
I can't stand here and tell our fans that I'm happy, because we're not winning, and they want wins. They don't care about these kind of positive things from our team.
That's Claude Julien in Montreal. He's right. They're at the point with their losing streak, having reached 8 games, that they don't care right now as to why. They just want to win. Just find a win somewhere. Scratch, claw, beg, borrow, steal, whatever you got to do. Just get us a win, because this has gone on far too long. For a team that has some pretty lofty expectations this year, playoffs seem like the minimum acceptable standard. For a Montreal Canadiens team that was right there on the precipice of the postseason last year and was just unable to get in the last week of the season. Scott Rintoul with you. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. Everybody's asking about the same guy. Everybody's asking about the same guy with the "you'd love him if you have him, but you can't stand him because you don't" list. I thought about him. I thought about him a lot. And I didn't put him on the list because I didn't think that he was detested as much as some of you are indicating. But we will debate this player, and we will get to him after we go to Montreal and talk to Eric Engels. And he's one that both markets are very familiar with. And one absolutely embraces, and the other is kind of jealous of. But we will talk about this player and whether he should be on the list or not. But yeah, the Montreal Canadiens. Here's to put into perspective the challenge the Habs face tonight. And it's hockey, so any team can win on any given night. There are a lot of random occurrences with a frozen disc bouncing around an uneven ice surface. We all know that. The Habs have lost 8 straight games. They host the Islanders, who've lost 7 games in total. That's it for the New York Islanders. 5 regulation losses, 2 losses after regulation. That adds up to 7, while the Habs are on this 8-game losing streak right now. Things are tough in Montreal. They haven't figured out all of the pieces, how they work together. I'm not sure where they're at with their goaltending situation and which part of it is more concerning for them right now in Montreal. But that's why we have an expert like Eric Engels, who covers that team, has done so for years. He's with Sportsnet in Montreal, and he joins me now from the other side of the country. Eric, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm great. It's an 8-game winless streak, Scotty.
Oh, yeah. We're not allowed to call it a losing streak, are we? Because they picked up some points. It all depends on the spin, right?
Well, that's the way they've kept the record since the 05-06 lockout. So we're all about the details here. So
we'll defer to that. The seats are always somewhat warm in Montreal, given the nature of the market. How does the current temperature compare to the heat that was on Marc Bergevin 2 years ago?
About as hot as it gets, particularly for a general manager that's in place now in his 8th season. And, you know, the Canadians are staring down the possibility of being the 4th addition and or staring down the possibility of being the 3rd addition in the 110-year history of the team to miss the playoffs 4 out of 5 years. I don't think anybody wants their name attached to a record like that. So, you know, it's understandably warm here, but with 55 games to go, for as much panic as there is in the fan base, I don't think anybody in the organization right now is panicked. Are they concerned? Absolutely. And they should be. You lose 8 games in a row, it's not a situation where you can sit back and say everything's going to be fine. So urgency is putting it mildly when it comes to the situation they're in and what they face in playing the New York Islanders tonight at the Bell Center, and they need to come out with 2 points.
What is the minimum expectation for this team this year?
The minimum expectation for this team would be that they'd be competitive all the way through for a playoff spot. I think, you know, the reality of the NHL right now, you look at 3 teams up top in Boston, St. Louis, and Washington, and you could probably put the next 25 in queue on a pretty similar plane. And yes, there's a variance in talent between some of those teams, but a bunch of things need to go right for them to make the playoffs. And, you know, you've seen some good teams this year, like Dallas and Toronto, go through hard times. Dallas started 1-7-1, I believe. And, you know, Toronto recently lost 6 games straight and then fired their coach. And now they've won 4 of 5. And, you know, it's a whole new ballgame. So that's the NHL now. And I think Canadians fans are cognizant of the reality of parity in this league right now. And I think they expect it with little turnover from last year's roster to this year's roster that there's a familiarity factor that would enable them to maybe take a step forward this year. I think that if you pulled the majority of their fans at the beginning of the year, they thought this is the year that they're going to make the playoffs. It's still a possibility, but obviously the odds get longer with each loss that piles up.
Sportsnet, Eric Engels joining me as the Habs try to bump their slump tonight in Montreal hosting the New York Islanders. You've watched this team. You know the composition of the roster. How many of the answers do you believe lie within?
I think this team is capable of playing much better hockey, or I should say achieving much better results. And I'm going to base that on what they showed in their last 2 games, which obviously are still losses, but much more to the template that Claude Julien is looking for in terms of the way they play. And, you know, for a while they really slid and were giving up way too many quality opportunities. And though Carey Price obviously wasn't playing his best hockey, in fact, it was far from it. He wasn't being given a chance to get his legs underneath him and find the way back to his game with the kind of chances the Canadians were giving up. So, you know, the whole group here realized the necessity to not force things offensively, especially given that I think right now they're the third highest scoring team at 5-on-5. They haven't had problems manufacturing offense, and I believe their power play is right in the middle of the pack at 16th overall. At least that's where it was when I checked last night. So, you know, and realizing they got to focus on the defensive side of the puck, they got back to a game plan that should generate wins. Unfortunately, it didn't, because confidence and frustration, you know, hit a different level once you've lost 6 games in a row, and it seems though a little mistake can cost you dearly. They need some good bounces. It's something Claude Julien was talking about over the last 2 days. You know, he talked about winning a Stanley Cup with the Bruins in 2011 and saying they wouldn't have gotten there without those good bounces. And at a time where things are tense and tight, and like I said, miniature mistakes can become so magnified. Yeah, you do need a couple bounces to go your way. And I think it would make a big difference for the Canadians if they could just play a really good game like they did their last two and end up on the winning side.
You mentioned the problem hasn't been scoring. It's been keeping the puck out of their own net. We've heard rumors about the possible acquisition of a left side defenseman for quite some time. How much does that fix, in your opinion?
It would help. It would help a lot. Especially given the news that came out yesterday, Victor Mete, who's one of the better guys they have on that side, is going to be out for at least 2 weeks with an ankle injury. This was an area of need going back to the offseason. They tried to acquire Jake Gardner and weren't able to convince him to come to Montreal. They acquired Ben Chiarot, who right now, without a doubt in my mind, is playing the best hockey of his life after a tough start to the season and getting adjusted to a completely different system in Montreal than what he was playing in Winnipeg. But they need help there, and it's not a secret. It's not a secret that Marc Bergevin is trying to keep, or, you know. But you got to ask yourself, you know, how many teams out there on December 3rd are looking to ship out a top four defenseman for a price that, you know, any general manager across the league wouldn't balk at this point. It's a very difficult situation. You know, I think everybody is looking at Marc Bergevin right now and saying he needs to do something drastic. And, you know, I'm not excluded from the bunch who believed, at least after Sunday's loss against Boston, that he needed to do something, that he couldn't sit on his hands and do nothing. But the possibility of making an impactful trade, he could search for value right now on the market and try to pull one of the type of moves he's been very successful at in his tenure as GM. But really prying out an impactful top four defenseman on December 3rd, some 80 days away from the trade deadline, is completely unrealistic in my mind. So they have to work with what they have. They have to play good team defense to account for that area of concern that they have. And if the goaltender and Carey Price looks the way he did against Boston in the loss on Sunday, I think they'll be okay.
The Montreal Canadiens are mired in an 8-game winless streak. I'm in conversation with Sportsnet's Eric Engels on that subject. You mentioned Carey Price. The goaltending situation is a complex one right now in Montreal. They just waived Keith Kincaid, so they haven't been getting quality starts from their backup. As you mentioned earlier, Price hasn't been as good, certainly recently, as we know he is capable of being. What is the biggest issue with the goaltending situation in Montreal in your mind?
Well, it's twofold. One, like I mentioned, you know, the type of chances the Canadians were giving up, not just over this skid, but obviously going back through their first 20 games where they put together a good record, you know, he played pretty well given the fact that they were giving up really good quality scoring chances, and not so much volume, but the actual quality of them and where the pucks are coming from in terms of, you know, right in the slot and in the scoring areas that teams like to take advantage of. And that was one issue. The other is that Price's game dipped in November, as it has over the last couple of years, for whatever reason. And, you know, when you continue to give up those scoring chances while your goaltender's play dips, you're not giving him much of a chance to reverse course. So that's one issue. The second issue, Keith Kincaid, you know, whether it was his fault completely or not, didn't inspire much confidence with his play and the limited opportunity he got here. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, he came here on a one-year, $1.75 million deal, obviously looking to resurrect his career and, you know, with the expectations he'd have to prove himself, but also was sold on the concept that he'd be used a little bit more frequently than he was to start. And the whole idea was to manage Carey Price's load. That didn't end up happening for whatever reason. And I think, you know, there's two parts to that. One is that, you know, they weren't too inspired by what Keith Kincaid was offering. And two, I think Claude Julien may be on a slightly different page than management in terms of what he wants Price's workload to be, because I think he sees an elite goaltender that he wants to ride. And it just, you know, for whatever reason, hasn't worked. And I think Marc Bergevin, as I mentioned, I said that he needed to do something. He couldn't just sit down and do nothing in terms of any kind of move for his team. He made a minor one yesterday in waving Kincaid and sending him down to the American Hockey League and calling up 20-year-old Caden Primo. But it's a minor one that could have some serious implications, because if it solves a problem they've been having and enables them to give Price a bit more rest and get something better out of him and gives Primo some confidence and an opportunity in his NHL debut to steal some points for this team, which I think he's capable of doing given his talent level, that could be a big thing swinging in their favor.
I think you just outlined one of the problems certain organizations have had with goaltending in the era we exist right now. I think most people are of the mind that if you can start your number one guy 55, maybe 60 games, but probably somewhere in the mid-50s, maybe even lower, and have him fresh for the playoffs, that's the ideal situation. But there's two parts to Carey Price. There's Carey Price, the goaltender, and we also know there's the contract that Carey Price carries as well. How much pressure does that contract put on Carey Price and him having to play so much in Montreal?
I think it puts a lot more pressure on the optics around Carey Price than it does the man himself. If you know anything about Carey Price, and I think a lot of people in your area do, this is a guy that is not going to take any more external pressure than, you know, the internal pressure he puts on himself. I don't think it adds anything really for him. At the end of the day, he's got what's been labeled before as the loneliest job in pro sports. He'd be the starting goaltender for the Montreal Canadiens in the footsteps of greats like Dryden and Patrick Roy and before them, Georges Vezina, Jacques Plante, the list goes on and on. That's a lot of pressure. But Carey Price, you know, is a unique individual who was chosen fifth overall in 2005 for the exact purpose of being able to hold up to that pressure. And I think in becoming the winningest goaltender in franchise history, he's proven he's capable of doing that. So if you want to add a zero to his contract, I don't think it changes all that much for him. It is a situation optically where, you know, I think people in the fan base say, you know, it's got to be perfection for what he's being paid. As far as the coaching staff is concerned, I don't think they look at his contract and say, well, we're paying him this amount, we got to get this amount out of him. I think they look at him and say, we're paying him this amount because we believe he's the best goaltender in the world and we're going to ride him. So I think, does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. It absolutely does. I think you went all the directions I wanted you to go with that. This one may be more difficult to answer. Marc Bergevin, we've seen him, by some people's particular opinion, be called one of the worst GMs in hockey 2 years ago. Last year, that stock rose a lot, and he was hailed by some as a hero for some of the moves he made for that organization. What does the general fan in Montreal think of Marc Bergevin's performance over the breadth of his career there?
You know what? I don't know if I could speak for the general fan because it's a mercurial issue, but I could speak for myself and what I feel. I think, you know, you go back a couple of years ago where they bottomed out at 28th and, you know, leading to that, failed to sign Andrei Markov and Alex Radulov to contracts and replace them with players like Carl Alsner and you know, what they did up front and bringing in a guy like Mark Strait, you know, to me, after that season, I think, you know, there was absolutely grounds to fire Marc Bergevin. And once the decision was made by Jeff Molson to keep Bergevin in place, I think he was very much set up to be successful because there was only one direction to take the Canadiens in, and that was to sell off some assets, build up some long-term assets. And I will give Bergevin full credit because just because you're set up for success doesn't mean that you will be successful. And the job that him and Trevor Timmons have done and their pro scouting has done in terms of on the trade market, you look at trades like Max Domi for Alex Galchenyuk, Joel Armia for nothing. They gave up literally nothing to get him. These types of moves, good players coming into Montreal and the type of assets they've collected through the draft and hoarding picks and making sure they keep holding on to them and let Trevor Timmons do his job, they deserve full marks for that job. Now, you know, you bring it into the current situation. Like I said at the top here, you don't want to be the GM attached to a record that only two additions prior to you in the 110-year history of the team have missed the playoffs 4 out of 5 years. You don't want to be a part of that, and it's already hard enough. And I think, you know, the goal that they set out was to make the playoffs this year, and I think it's imperative that they do, because if you really want to make progress as an organization, you're not just doing it by building up young star caliber talent. You're doing it by giving that talent the type of experience it needs moving forward so that the process becomes shorter than it would otherwise. You know, you look at the Leafs and what they've done over a few years, and people tend to forget that their best players are some of the youngest players you know, around. They're all under 22 years old, and the experience they've gotten in the playoffs should be able to catapult them to the next level by the next time they get there, if they continue to build on what they're doing right now with Sheldon Keefe. So all to say, you know, Marc Bergevin and the Canadiens need to make the playoffs this year, despite the fact that the long-term plan they've put in place is an excellent one, and the future looks bright. I don't think that'll be enough for him to keep his job if they miss the playoffs.
Eric, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. They are always interesting, which keeps you on your toes. Thank you very much for shedding some light on what's going on in Montreal right now. Really appreciate the time.
Happy to do it anytime.
That's Eric Engels of Sportsnet in Montreal. As mentioned, the Habs in an 8-game winless streak right now. The Islanders come in 18-5-2. That's kind of how it is when you're in one of those slumps. They don't send you the easiest teams in the league. They always seem to send you the better ones, and the Islanders have been one of those at the beginning of the season. Busy night on ice tonight. We rolled out a list for you. We rolled out our top five Tuesday. Everybody's asking about the same guy. The same guy who plays for the Calgary Flames, the guy who's going to be captain there one day, the guy that the Vancouver Canucks could have drafted but did not, the guy by the name of Matthew Tkachuk. And I'm getting this from both markets right now. A couple of emails come in right away from Calgary. Texts, I should say. You forgot Tkachuk. Okay, I expected to be Tkachuk to be number one. LOL. Why isn't he? Vancouver saying the same thing. What about Matthew Tkachuk? Allie in Calgary says, surprised Chucky didn't make your top five. I thought about him. I thought about him a lot, especially because of the thing with Drew Doughty and how good he is. And I stand to be corrected on this. You can fire up the texts all you want. You can hit me up on the text message inbox or on the fan feedback line. I didn't think he was reviled as much as some of the other guys on the list. To me, there was more healthy respect for him than some of the other players on the list. Now, I stand to be corrected on that. Someone texted in the name Corey Perry. Corey Perry just isn't as relevant anymore. Corey Perry would have been there in his prime. Ryan Kessler would have been there. I know he's sitting out this year. We'll see if he ever comes back. Corey Perry would have been there for sure. Ryan Kessler would have been there for sure. But Corey Perry, his relevance in the league has been diminished somewhat. He's playing a lesser role in Dallas. He's not seen as one of the more prominent players on his own team anymore. Come playoff time, they're going to hope Corey Perry still has some goals left, still has that feistiness left. And maybe at that point in time, we're having a different conversation. But that's why Corey Perry didn't make the list. Matthew Tkachuk, I could see putting him there, and it felt as though 2 years ago he would have been there. I think he still gets under the skin of the opposition. I think he's a nomination for the list. And perhaps you guys can tell me what you think. Should he be in the top five? He is one of those guys you love if you have him, but I almost look at him as most fan bases understanding that he is to be loved instead of despised. It's a complicated conversation when it comes to Matthew Tkachuk. Joey in Richmond says, Ryan Reeves. Do people detest Ryan Reeves? Or has Ryan Reeves assumed the role of lovable heavyweight that has existed in the National Hockey League forever? I know there are more and more people that are down on fighting. I'm in that category. I don't need to see it every single game. It happens out of emotion every once in a while, so be it. Should there be harsher penalties, we can go down that road. Ryan Reeves, because of his persona off the ice and because he is quick with the one-liners, to me, he's assumed the role of the lovable heavyweight. But hit me up. If you think Ryan Reeves is a guy that should be on that list, as Joey in Richmond is suggesting, you can agree, you can disagree. I didn't put him there because I think most people kind of smile when they see Ryan Reeves, unless they're Sharks fans. Sharks fans don't like him a whole lot because of what's going on between him and Evander Kane, and that's one of the better rivalries head-to-head in the NHL right now. The next time those two play, should be great theater. You would think, anyway. There is no love lost between those two players. Keep the text coming in. You can hit me up on that. You can hit me up on what happened on Monday Night Football, which we'll get into in the next hour as well. And the conversation continues around Mike Babcock. We haven't heard many other allegations around Bill Peters in the last couple of days, but the stories about Mike Babcock continue to come out. Mark Crawford's under investigation right now. That story took a weird twist yesterday. Sean Avery's the guy who, over the course of the weekend, said, yeah, he kicked me when I was on the bench in L.A. And then Sean Avery yesterday posted a video on social media that basically said, I'm not sure why I said that about him. He was my second favorite NHL coach ever. He made me into a better player. I love Crow. That's a fact. It was a weird twist and turn. Sean Avery's a different cat. Has been for a very long time. So I'm not sure we can be surprised that he did a 180 of sorts, an about face of sorts. I think there's a lot of people that would disagree with him that he deserved to be kicked, even though he might have been a troublesome player to deal with and had his own behavioral issues. But these stories continue throughout the National Hockey League. And the ones about Mike Babcock keep coming out. I have an interesting text that I will respond to on that subject. Alex Burrows will be featured in the second hour as well. Big night for him, and I will sit down to him. Something people forget. Something people forget about his most prominent moment, his most prominent game in Vancouver. I will ask him about on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
Second and eight. Wilson looks right, comes back to set things up with Penny inside the 10 and into the end zone.
Bunch of different guys got it done. They were really good on the ground last night, the Seattle Seahawks. They did what they do, and they do it in the way they almost always do it. Seattle finds a way. That's what Seattle is best at. It's what Russell Wilson is best at, even though it wasn't all on him last night. But they almost never make it easy on themselves. That is just the Seahawk way under Pete Carroll. Scott Rintoul with you into the second hour of the show. Alex Burrows set to join me at the bottom of the hour. He is going into the Ring of Honor in Vancouver tonight. One of the more unpredictable hockey journeys that you will see to very close to the top. A guy who almost got to lift a Stanley Cup, a guy who played far better offensively at the NHL level than anyone could have predicted, perhaps even Burrows himself, something we will talk about at the bottom of the hour, and a guy who is coaching now. He's with the Laval Rocket. I wonder what the last couple of weeks have meant to Alex Burrows, if he's looked at the way he coaches, or if he's been such a recent addition to the coaching fraternity that he knew about the way the game has changed, the way players have changed, the way that communication has changed around the game. I'll be interested to find those things out at the bottom of the hour. Keep your texts coming in. We'll continue to hit on some of these topics. One of them that came in about Mike Babcock, I don't quite understand. I would love clarification. It's an unsigned text. I'll read it during the course of this segment as well. And we will get to what they're saying. Elliot Friedman had some really interesting comments on the Taylor Hall situation. I think you're going to want to hear those. That's just starting to percolate in the background. But I do want to get back to the Monday night. Seattle Seahawks win. They are the number two seed in the NFC by virtue of their overtime win over the 49ers. 10-2 teams, Seahawks now have the advantage. They have the tiebreaker right now. Those teams will meet in the final game of the regular season for both. And boy, there could be a division title on the line. Wouldn't that be something in Seattle on December 29th? Something big to play for. 49ers have a tough schedule between now and then, so it might not mean that. If they fall more than a game behind the Seahawks, Seahawks don't have an easy road either. And that happens this coming weekend against the LA Rams, who we've counted out for a while, but divisional game on the road. Rams desperate right now. That result helped them to a certain degree last night. Minnesota still just a game up on the Rams in the wild card chase, so it's not as though the Rams don't have something to play for. But as the Seahawks lead their division, as they are the number two seed, the Seahawks are like every other team that is headed to the playoffs in the NFC. Every other team. There's a lot to like. You name me a team, I'll tell you what there is to like about them. But there are one or two aspects of every single team right now that's in a playoff position in the NFC or just on the outside that worry you a little bit. And the Seahawks are in that same conversation. There's no team that you look at and say, well, that's the team to beat this year. You can make a great case for all of them, save maybe for Dallas. Dallas is that one team that I'm not sure. Yeah, the resume is there as far as Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott and Amari Cooper and go down the list, and their defense is good, and they've added Michael Bennett, all of those things. But you know what that is in Dallas. You know what the big question is there, and I'll get to them. But as you run down that list, you start at the top. Seattle's the 2 seed right now. New Orleans is the number 1 seed. People have been asking this since the playoffs last season, since the stretch drive last season. Does Drew Brees have enough left in his arm? He is great. He's going to the Hall of Fame. He's one of the best quarterbacks of his generation. He's got himself a Super Bowl. Does he have enough left in his arm when push comes to shove in the playoffs? And if they can shut down Michael Thomas, they being any team that plays the New Orleans Saints in the playoffs, if they can limit him to a certain degree, can the Saints get Alvin Kamara going? Do they have enough other weapons in their offense this year to make them a legitimate Super Bowl team? Seattle, are their receivers, are their DBs good enough? They've got parts you like. There's parts that you worry about. You don't have any question about Russell Wilson. You like some of what you see in the front seven. It's a pass rush that at some points has been there. Certainly showed up against San Francisco, but you wonder a little bit if they can get there consistently in the playoffs. Well, that's the real question. The pass rush slash secondary, that is the biggest question about the team, and the receivers to a lesser extent in Seattle. The Packers, they have offensive line questions. They don't have a great defense. It's a good defense. Some days it's good. Most days it's kind of average. Is that good enough to win in the playoffs? In the AFC, or in the NFC, I should say, which does feature some stout defensive teams. Dallas, the 4 seed right now. Coaching, coaching, coaching. Is that important in the NFL? It's fairly important. It's more important there than any other league. In football, the head coach wields more control over the game than in any other sport. So, yeah, that's a big question in Dallas. 49ers, you have the same question as everybody else. Jimmy Garoppolo in big moments, is he going to be able to get it done? Same question you have about the Vikings, who are the 6th seed right now. Kirk Cousins and a head coach who is fairly conservative by nature in Mike Zimmer. Those are your questions. They're in the Rams. They're the 7th seed right now. They're on the outside looking in. But Jared Goff under pressure, Todd Gurley's health. Those are the questions in LA. That's the NFC for you, folks. There are questions about every single team. And the Seahawks are the epitome of riding the tight margin and coming out on the right side of it so often this season. They're 9-1 in one-score games. I will tell you a truth here that Seahawks fans will not like to hear, but it's the truth. There is a letdown game coming. I don't know if it's this weekend against the Rams. I don't know if it's one of their other games down the stretch. Doesn't feel like it would be that road game in Carolina they play the week after. But there's a letdown game coming somewhere. They ride too close to that edge too often. And somewhere there's a letdown game coming. And I'm not saying that because I happen to like the 49ers when I'm not doing my real job, when I'm a fan, when I'm not just analyzing and coming up with talking points for this show. I'm not saying it because of that, but there is a letdown game coming somewhere. And if I were a Seahawks fan, I would say, I kind of hope that comes before the playoffs. Yeah, I would want one of those top 2 seeds. I would want to buy. Pretty essential to getting to a Super Bowl to have one of those. But I would hope the letdown game comes before then, because one of these games, not all of the bounces, they're not all going to go that way. Greg Zuerlein isn't necessarily going to miss a kick. You're not always going to win the coin toss in overtime. Something's going to happen. That's coming somewhere. I'm calling that shot right now. Scott Rintoul, this is the Scott Rintoul Show. There are texts coming in on the story of the last couple of weeks, and it is the coaching story, and it's one that is going to try to get, or pardon me, it's not going to try to get, it's going to get more legs. That is going to happen. We are going to see more stories come out, and in the last couple of days, you've seen more stories come out about Mike Babcock. I had this one come in, which I found strange. What happened to innocent until proven guilty? This cancel culture is outrageous. I have no idea how that applies to what Chris Chelios and Johan Franzen talked about in the last couple of days. I have no idea how that applies. Mike Babcock lost his job, and then a story came out about Mitch Marner, which was corroborated, which was printed, which was, in fact, validated by Mike Babcock himself, who said he made a mistake via text message. In the last couple of days, this story that Chris Chelios put out there about Johan Franzen being berated on the bench, Franzen confirmed the story, and it was very emotional for him to talk about. And he's been going through a very difficult time since his playing days. Some of it has to do with concussions. Some of it has to do with mental health. And what Mike Babcock did to him on the bench and some of the things he said to him, and that was in front of people. And as Chris Chelios said in the podcast, I don't even know what was said behind closed doors. Those had a very, very negative impact on Johan Franzen by his admission in that Swedish interview yesterday. No one's denied the story, so I'm not sure about this innocent until proven guilty. Chelios put the story out. The principal party confirmed the story. Mike Babcock, they tried to reach him via text, various reporters. They haven't seen a response. I'm not sure how this innocent until proven guilty applies in that story. It's been corroborated. But again, if you were the texter in question, send that in. This one comes in, JP from Abby. I could never condone what Peters did, going back to the Bill Peters situation, because there's no room for that language in any area of life. I played with many African-American players, and no coach or player would ever think of using that language. I do think this has gone way too far down the rabbit hole at this point, however. We are getting to the point where tough coaching is being labeled as abuse. I think this type of coaching will be phased out with this new generation, but I don't think we should label these current coaches as bad people for just trying to light a fire under players the only way they knew how. That's from JP and Abby, and I think that's a very good talking point because there are different transgressions that have been alleged here, and I think what you said at the very end of this text, JP, is very accurate. It is the only way they knew how. That doesn't make it right, and I'm not saying you're condoning all of the action that was taken by some of these coaches who were involved in these allegations over the year, but it is the only way they knew how. Kevin Bieksa pointed it out in a different way on the weekend on Hockey Night in Canada. He said, here's a newsflash that some people might not know. Not all coaches are smart, and they don't have a lot of tools in their toolboxes. It is the only way they knew how. But as we evolve, we get better tools. Does it mean past behavior was right? No, it doesn't. But what does it mean as far as how accountable we hold people? I understand the point you're trying to make, and I think it's a good one. What are the consequences of those actions? It may depend on how often they occurred, to what level they occurred. Was anything done to help remedy them along the way? Is there accountability on behalf of the person who's in the middle of these allegations as well? This was one of the things that was at the heart of the initial interview Akeem Aliyu did with Frank Saravelli in the piece he wrote that has deservedly had a lot of attention. Aliyu said, I think if there'd been an apology, we could have moved on. That's part of what is at the heart of the Carolina story as well with Bill Peters. I said this yesterday, and I still don't have an answer, and I may never get an answer. I don't know what the leadership group asked for. I'm not sure how it was remedied with the team. If the players who were aggrieved at the time said, okay, that's an acceptable solution to me, I don't agree with what was done, but the solution you've laid out, Ron Francis and team leadership and Bill Peters, which included an apology apparently at the time, I'm okay with that. I can live with that. We can move on from here. And that's part of the discussion about the coaches that are going to be in these allegations as well. Do they admit that what they did before was not the right way to do it? It's the only way they knew how. They are better people now. Or, hey, I'm here for being better. That's what I'm all about. I didn't know any better. It's the only way I was raised. It's the only way I was coached growing up. I was a product of my environment, and I want to get better. Is it that attitude? Or is it, I've got nothing to apologize for. Why are you pointing the finger at me? That's just the way it was. Those are two different reactions. Extremely different reactions. Hit me up. You've got the fan feedback line. You've got the text message inbox. It's a conversation that's going to continue for quite some time, and there are going to be a lot of different facets of it as we go on. But let's get to what we get to every day at this point. Let's get to what they're saying.
What are you talking about, man?
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooks.
Here's what they're saying.
Yeah, it's time for what they're saying here on the Scott Rentoul Show. Elliot Friedman was on yesterday in Calgary, and the Taylor Hall situation is starting to bubble and percolate a little bit. People are calling. The Devils are calling around. Here's what Friedman had to say about where this is headed currently.
I do think the Devils are taking an honest run at it now. I think they'd like to see if they can, you know, like, it's been a tough season for them. I know there's people like who debate they're not as bad as they've looked. They've had some ugly losses, but they feel they're better than they've shown. But I think they're motivated to try to see what those stories only get out. I know because I've done them when somebody is either a motivated seller or a motivated purchaser. And I think the Devils at this point in time are a motivated seller. They want to see if they can jump the market now. And so I think they will. I think Colorado is interested. I think Edmonton has interest. I've heard Dallas. I've heard St. Louis. I got to wonder if, you know, Montreal, Bergevin. I mean, the last really big in-season deal he did was Jeff Petrie. And that was almost 5 years ago. Like, he makes his big deals in the off season, but you're looking at where they're going. And I'm just going to throw another dark horse out there, and that's Arizona. I have a sneaking suspicion that they might be in on this. Like, they're off to a good start. They just got through their hardest month of the season schedule-wise. They're very much in it. What do they need? They need scoring. I could see Arizona being in on this.
Whether or not they have the assets to make the deal, that's a different discussion. And whether or not Taylor Hall thinks that's a place he would consider signing long-term, that's another discussion. If you are an acquiring general manager for Taylor Hall, you are either of the, hey, we're good for now, and if we get an extension, that's great philosophy, or you're of the Doug Wilson philosophy in San Jose. Doug Wilson's philosophy when he went out and got Erik Karlsson was, I know we don't have him under contract, and I know he's not sure if he wants to be here long-term, but we believe that once we get him here, he sees what we're all about, he sees the culture we've established in San Jose, his family is settled, and they have a place to live, and they see what this community is like, we're pretty convinced that he'll want to re-sign. Turns out they were right. Whether you like the contract or not, Doug Wilson bet on his culture, he bet on his organization, he bet on the players in that room, and he bet on his community, and he was right. Does Arizona feel the same way? It certainly doesn't jump out as a stage. That's one of the things Taylor Hall is reportedly interested in. He wants to be in the playoffs, so Arizona, the thick of the race they're in right now, how close they were last year, some of the steps they've taken, maybe Taylor Hall sees that as a team. Or maybe he wants a more sure option. I don't know. But he wants to go somewhere where he's going to be in the playoffs, and that's where his next contract is going to be signed. Is it enough of a stage for now? I don't know. I did see this thrown out on Twitter, and I saw it get hammered pretty quickly. It was just a question that was being thrown out. But the answer was an overwhelming no from Vancouver hockey fans. And it was this. If you're the Canucks, with the understanding you could sign Hall to an extension, would you give up Quinn Hughes or Elias Pettersson in trade? And the answer was a very quick no, 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 no chance. Doesn't mean Taylor Hall is not a very good player, but no one is giving up young currency like that. Not young currency that has already proven it can play in the National Hockey League and be very good in the National Hockey League and look like the trajectory is to be great in the National Hockey League. That's not what you're going to do in the Taylor Hall deal. Mark Stone is a very good foundation, very good basis to look at the framework of a potential deal. If you're not going to give up a player off your roster, the Ottawa Senators last year got Erik Brännström, which was the best prospect Vegas could offer and a guy that they think is going to be great on their blue line for years to come. They got another prospect, maybe works out, maybe doesn't, and they got a second round pick. There wasn't even a first involved in that one. Now, if it's a lesser prospect, we're talking about a higher pick. Okay, we can have that conversation. But that is the potential framework for a Taylor Hall deal. Do I think there are other ways they can make it work? Yep. I know in Calgary, the Johnny Gaudreau, Taylor Hall conversation has been thrown out there many times. I don't know if Brad Treliving wants to shake things up, especially given the way things by no design of his own have been shaken up in Calgary already. There's already been a major change. I'm guessing they slow play it from here on in. I've seen some people say, because my point at the time was, I'm not sure that he's the right type of winger for Sean Monahan. Somebody said, well, is he the right type of winger for Elias Lindholm? It's a very good point. It's a very good counterpoint. Taylor Hall can fit in a lot of places. The Edmonton one, to me, I just can't see it happening. I just can't see Taylor Hall re-signing there. Even if this plays out all season, the Oilers are a playoff team. Can you see him going back to that market with some of the things he said about that market? He didn't rip them. He just said, yeah, it's a tough place to play. There's a lot of negative press there at times. I'm not sure he wants to go back into that fishbowl. Does that rule out all Canadian markets? Not necessarily, but he knows that one. He knows what it's like. I'm not sure he's choosing that if he gets to free agency. Interesting stuff from Elliot Friedman, a conversation we're going to be having for quite some time as well, because I don't see the Devils getting this done in a hurry. But they're gauging the market right now. Todd Bertuzzi was on the morning airwaves in Vancouver today with James Cebulski and Perry Solkowski on the starting lineup. And he was asked about where things are headed with this coaching conversation. And Todd is one of those guys who played for Mike Babcock, played for Mark Crawford, who is in the news for a couple of reasons right now. He played with Johan Franzen. He didn't talk about any of those situations specifically today, but he did see where he would. He did say where he would like to see this conversation go.
Nothing is really good when it comes to this kind of stuff. There was a culture that existed in our sport, but now with players speaking out, this absolutely and should have never ever have happened or shouldn't continue. And my focus is not only on the NHL level players who are speaking out, and I hope that this gets concluded and fixed the proper way. It also has to stop in minor hockey, and especially in the CHL. These are very vulnerable kids and vulnerable people. We got to learn how to speak better to people and how to treat people. And I'm really hoping with this coming out that the culture changes and changes for the right way and the right reasons for these young kids.
Yeah, Todd, I think
that's Todd Bertuzzi on the morning show in Vancouver today. And I think everybody agrees with that. Everybody wants a better way. Everybody wants something better for young, impressionable people coming up. And, you know, we had the comment yesterday on the Fad feedback line saying, I find it difficult with some of the allegations from the likes of a Daniel Carcillo when you realize that he was a bully, that he didn't always treat people well. Well, Carcillo copped to that. And basically what he said is, I'm a product of my environment. I want to make reparations with those that I have offended, with those people that I've disrespected over the years. I'm here for that. But you guys need to understand that part of this is product of environment, and we need to change the environment. That's where the conversation goes after this. Last but certainly not least, Carson Palmer, a guy who played not to the age Tom Brady played, but a guy who played into the latter stage of his career, dealt with some injury issues along the way, taking a look at what's happening in New England. He was on Good Show this morning in Toronto on the Fan 590 and had this to say about the man most called the GOAT.
At the end of the day, people don't want to admit it, but Brady looks like he's 42. I mean, he just does. He's not as accurate as he used to be. He still is, no doubt. I'm not knocking Brady, Patriot fans. I'm not saying he's not still the greatest quarterback to ever play the game. But the guy's 42. They really needed Antonio Brown to work out. They needed a guy that they can throw a slant to that can take it 80 yards. They just don't have that quick hitter.
No, they don't. Antonio Brown wants him to have that quick hitter. He's trying to get back in there. That's not going to happen. But yeah, Tom Brady looks like he's 42 right now. People are careful. They don't want to label the Patriots as done, but they do look vulnerable right now. We'll turn our attention back to hockey next. Alex Burrows goes into the Ring of Honor in Vancouver tonight. Did he think he was going to get drafted? What was that process like? Just part of the conversation we'll have next right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Campoli has it, flips it, Burrow steals, cutting in, shoots, scores! They slayed the dragon! Alex Burrows, 5:22 into overtime. Game 7 goes to Vancouver, and the Canucks
are off to the second round.
We couldn't find one of his more notable goals, so we had to settle for that one. Alex Burrows slayed the Dragon for the Vancouver Canucks, was part of that team in 2011 that went to the Stanley Cup Final against the Boston Bruins, and he will be honored tonight in Vancouver. He goes into the Ring of Honor with the Vancouver Canucks, where he spent most of his 14 seasons in the NHL. He joins me now. Alex, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me, Scotty.
Hey, no problem whatsoever. You look like you've lost a little weight since your playing days. You've slimmed down a little.
I always had to eat so much to just keep on the weight I went in my playing days, so... Right now, back to a normal diet, I'd say. Really enjoying my time as an assistant coach in Laval, at Montreal's farm team. So I'm liking it, and I'm feeling good. The body feels good.
You were always such a hard worker. You worked out so hard. Do you still do that, but just in a different way now? Or do the coaching hours just mean that you don't have time for that anymore?
Well, I think the coaching hours is way more than I first expected. And to all the coaches I've had, I know they put in a lot of time to make sure that we were on the same page and I would get better, my teammates would get better. So that's what I try to do. I don't spend as much time in the gym, that's for sure. I still get on the ice every day and run the back skates with the LT players or the guys that are rehabbing. So I'm really enjoying my time.
Alex Burrows, 14 seasons in the National Hockey League, goes into the Canucks Ring of Honor tonight. He joins me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. You didn't get drafted. Did you think you were going to be drafted?
Never. I wasn't even close of being drafted when I was 17 years old. I think I was playing midget double A, so I didn't have any scouts coming to my games. And for me, the NHL was so far away at that point. Hockey's always been my number one passion, but I quickly realized that in that area, I was a bit younger. I was really small and at late puberty. I started growing when I was probably 18 and 19, and that's when I started maybe being a little bit better player and knowing that I still needed a lot of hard work to get to the NHL. And good thing I had some good coaches, good teammates along the way that helped me get there.
And you're the poster boy for the ECHL because you went to the ECHL, then you went to the AHL, then you get to the National Hockey League, and you have an incredible impact at that level as well. When you were that teenager who started to grow and you still wanted to play hockey, what did you think a good life in hockey would be?
Oh, I thought it was all glamorous being in the NHL, and it must have been so much fun, but I quickly realized when I get to the NHL that it's so much work and the grind really grinds you down, like the long travels, the mental grind of winning a big game, you're so pumped up, and then losing a heartbreaker, then you're so down on yourself. So for me, I had to find really quick that I needed to be a even keel mentality to just keep getting better every day, and that's always going to be able to stay in the league as long as I did. But it's easier said than done, that's for sure.
When you made the AHL with the Manitoba Moose, I know you thought that would be just fine. Like, of course you want to get the NHL, yep. But did you think you'd almost made it? Like, hey, if I can stay in this league and I can play for a bunch of years, we're good. Like, I'll cash in my chips.
That's exactly how I thought. When I finally got to the American Hockey League, I was making $450 a week in the ECHL. And now when I got called up to the American Hockey League, I made it $45,000. I thought that was pretty sweet living, $45,000. I'm playing hockey. I'm still a young guy. I thought that was pretty sweet, but I knew I was only one step away from being an NHLer, and that's always been my dream ever since I was a kid. So, and during that lockout year, 2004-05, we had guys like Kessler, Alex Auld, Josh Green, all guys, Lee Gorin, all guys that had played in the NHL the previous years. So now I'm always thinking, like, I'm skating, I'm on the team with guys that played in the NHL last year. So if I keep working and getting better and keep pushing myself to get better, I might have a chance one day. And lucky enough, a year later, I was able to get my first chance to play for the Canucks.
Alex Burrows, 14 seasons in the National Hockey League, most of them with the Vancouver Canucks. He goes into the Ring of Honor tonight. He joins me here this morning on the Scott Rintoul Show. How important was that lockout year, not just for you, but for a lot of the players on that Moose team that would go on to the Vancouver Canucks?
Always huge. For me, it was really good. I think for a guy like Kess, like guy like Kevin Bieksa, a guy like even Aldi, Rick Rippon, I think it was all good for us to play in the league at that point, because the league was so strong. So many good players that played in the NHL the year before were all in the American League. So teams were really strong. A lot of NHLers that were down in the minors competing three games in three nights and doing the bus rides and whatnot. And we had a really good team in Winnipeg. And it was such a fun year because we closed out the Winnipeg Arena and opened the new MTS Center that year. And for me, being living by myself in Winnipeg, just behind the new rink, we could spend the day at the rink the entire time. And it was brand new, super nice locker room. We'd be on the ice all day. We obviously practiced as a team, but then guys would go see their family. But us young guys, we'd stay at the rink. Randy Carlyle always made sure that we'd do the extra work on the ice and in the gym. So it was so cold in Winnipeg, and you didn't want to go outside, so you stayed at the rink in this beautiful setup, and that was living the dream for me, just being at the rink all day and having fun playing hockey.
I noticed when you said the name Rick Rippon, I see the look in your eyes. Yeah. That's still an emotional topic. Luc Bourdon, I know, yeah, it was an emotional topic. I saw him playing. They were playing a World Junior game from 2007 just the other day, and I saw, yeah, him score a goal, and I sort of had that same moment as well. Why did you have such an emotional connection with those players in particular?
Well, I think, Rick, I think we had this similar story. Undrafted, came out of junior and played with us in Manitoba, and feisty, didn't have it easy in junior, and always wanted to get better. And I think we got called up pretty much at the same time with Vancouver, and we had a close bond. We knew what to expect of each other. We had different role, different style a little bit, but deep down, we both wanted to play in the NHL for a long time, and too bad that Rick was suffering from a mental illness, and it was just super disappointing. And for Luke, Luke was just a good old Maritimer that came in as a 19-year-old, I'd say, and I was the only French-Canadian player on the team, and I think that's really was our bond right from the get-go. And I tried to help Luke as much as possible, knowing he was a big prospect for the organization and he had a tremendous potential. So I wanted to make sure he felt comfortable coming to the rink every day and being a Canuck. And we gelled right off the get-go. We were really good friends. Our girlfriends got along really well. And it was just so tragic and so sad that he had that accident that summer, the next summer.
So there's a player you took under your wing when he got to Vancouver. When you arrived in Vancouver, who's the player who was the biggest influence on you?
For me, I was lucky enough when I got called up that Kevin Bieksa and Ryan Kessler were there. So they were young guys, and they helped me away from the rink, and we had the dinners. But for me, I was lucky enough to sit next to Trevor, and Trevor taught me so much. Just the way to play the right way, play the game the right way, and just to how to conduct yourself as a member of a Vancouver Canuck, either with the training staff, the coaches, the media, just the way he conducted himself in the community. I would always look up to Trevor a whole lot, and I think that first year sitting next to him in the locker room, I learned a lot, and I think I always remember how much Trevor helped me to become a Canuck and helped me so I could have this kind of career.
205 goals in the National Hockey League, all but 12 of them with the Vancouver Canucks. Alex Burrows joins me here on a day in which he goes into the Ring of Honor for the Vancouver Canucks. You mentioned Trevor Lynn and the connection with the community. When did you feel the connection with this community? Because you talk to people in Vancouver, they still love you, Alex.
Well, I think the people in Vancouver, like the Canucks fans, have always been so good to me. They've always treated me fairly through the good times, the bad times. And it's always been like so much fun to play, and I've always felt that support. And somehow all these sellouts that we used to have when we used to play, it kind of created that energy inside my belly, and I always wanted to make sure that I was going to work as hard as I could to make them proud. But as a Canuck player, like, you're not only asked to be a good hockey player, but you're also asked to be a good human being in the community. And as you get older and you start having kids and your priorities change, and you start realizing those experiences that we've had, that I've had and my teammates have had working in the community, either at Canuck's place or family skates, anything we used to do in the community, those are super life-changing experiences that I really enjoyed. And it makes you feel good that you might change somebody's life by taking a picture, taking an autograph, or taking 2 minutes of your day. And for them, it's like the biggest thing, and it's super humbling. And I think those are the stories that I've really liked, and I think that's maybe why the people in the community have connected with me.
And everybody here did connect with you. And as I mentioned, you were really embraced by Vancouver. Other fan bases couldn't stand you. You were one of those guys. We did a top five list last hour. It was based on you. Like the top five guys, you'd love them if you had them, but you probably couldn't stand them if you didn't. Did you relish that?
I never really put that much thought into it. I always loved playing on the road for some reason. I loved when the road building was dead quiet and you could hear a pin drop. That meant that we were doing something good and that we had taken the game over. And I always enjoyed playing on the road for that reason and make the other fan base lose it or being upset at me or at our team. But I always loved playing at Rogers Arena. I think this building was really rocking for a number of years. We always knew that they were going to be behind us, and very rarely they treated us unfairly.
Well, you could hear a pin drop during the course of that Chicago series, probably after Game 5 when you guys lost at home and the Blackhawks were on their way back. Let's go back to 2011, Game 7 against Chicago. Before we even get into the game, you're thinking about it the day before. You're thinking about it leading up to the game. Were you aware at the time of how important that game was, not just for that playoff run, Alex, but for the future of the team?
Oh, no, for sure. I was for sure. I remember my teammates were too, that we had such a good group of guys. We liked each other so much. We liked to be at the rink so much together. And we were like first place in the league, first power play, first PK, best goals for, less goals against. Like, we had a really good team, and we had been together through some hard time the previous years, losing to Chicago in the second round. But that was our year. We knew it, that was our year. And now playing against the Blackhawks, up 3-0, now it's tied 3-3. We knew how important that Game 7 was. And I remember we were staying at the Pac Rim in Cole Harbour, and to limit as many distractions as possible. And I remember driving with Kess to the rink that game, and we just knew we were going to find a way to win that game. And who knows what would have happened if we had lost that game. With maybe management would have been gone, maybe coaching staff would have been gone, all our teammates, maybe the Twins, Kess, Juice, Lou, me, myself, Hammer, like so many guys, who knows what would have happened. And so we didn't want it to end, not only for that playoff run, but we enjoyed being around each other, and we had to find a way to get it done. And I was so happy that we were able to win that game.
Well, and you're the guy who scores the goal, and everybody remembers the Slay the Dragon goal, Game 7, overtime. You get that. People might not remember you scored the other goal in that game for the Canucks as well, and they might not remember you were in the penalty box for 2 minutes in overtime. What were those 2 minutes like? Game 7, overtime, and you're sitting there in the penalty box watching the Blackhawks on the power play.
Well, for me, that game was the craziest game of my career. Like you mentioned, I scored the first goal. Great setup by Ryan Kesler. And then in the third period, I don't know if you remember, but I missed a penalty shot. I got tripped on a breakaway, and I got a penalty shot, and I made the worst move that I've ever done in my career in a penalty shot. I didn't change my speed, didn't change my angle. That terrible shot. Like, it was the worst penalty shot ever. And even then, they got a power play late in the game, and they scored on the PK with like a minute left, and I was kind of involved in that situation where I feel I could have maybe prevented that goal. So that was another bad play. Then a penalty that was the worst 2 minutes of my life, sitting with a lazy hooking penalty in the offensive zone in overtime, like terrible penalty. And but I knew that my guys could pull it off for me. Everybody wanted to win so bad, so I knew they could pull it off. And we had pre-scouted them, like, now it's Game 7, so we know what they're trying to do in their power play. And I still remember we talked about that goal line play, and Lou read it perfectly. And obviously, I would have liked Kevin to cut that pass, but Taze made that pass to Patrick Sharp, and Lou made that unbelievable shoulder save. And I think, like, everybody talks about the goal and slaying the Dragon, but that save is why we kept playing and why I had an opportunity to score the game winner. So I'll forever remember that save for Lou, for saving my in the penalty box at that time. And who knows what the story would be different for sure if that goal would have gone in. I got a chance to score that big goal afterwards.
The best season you ever had in junior hockey was 35 goals. You matched that in the NHL. I don't know if you ever believed you would reach those heights, did you?
No, never. I always hoped that I was going to be able to be a goal scorer, but I quickly realized that when I first came up in the NHL that I wasn't going to be a goal scorer right from the get-go. I needed to learn how to play the pro game. I needed to establish myself and find a chair that where I could succeed. And Kroll gave me that opportunity right off the get-go, that he believed in me and really taught me what it took to play in the NHL. And then later on, as I got AV, and AV gave me my chance in 2009 to play with the Twins, my timing of it was perfect. I had witnessed the Twins for 4 years. I've witnessed them play with different line mates. I've witnessed them see how they wanted to play the game and be successful playing the game. And for me, it was straightforward. As much as I could maybe make plays and stuff, my role was to give them the puck and give them as many opportunities to have some success with the puck. And they could create way better than I could, and I didn't mind it. I gave them the puck as many times as possible, and I went to the net and I tried to get open there. And it kind of worked perfectly as a line. And it was a good time, and I really miss those days. And scoring goals, I think the timing of it was good. The Twins were in their prime. We had a really good team, and I was just really lucky to be a part of it.
I know I'm getting the wrap-up sign here, but I want to ask you one more question quickly. You're in coaching now. It's been a tough couple of weeks for coaches, tough couple of weeks for hockey. I imagine you've reflected on how you go about delivering your message, how you do what you do. But there's a lot of good hockey stories out there as well. Which coach had the most positive impact on your career? Whether it was somebody in minor hockey or along the professional route, who was it?
Well, I think they've all had a positive impact in my career. I could talk about how Crow gave me my first chance and how good he was at teaching me how to play the game, to AV that really gave me like great opportunities to succeed and taught me how to play the right way. He was like really good to me, and his honesty in our one-on-one meetings. I still remember after my second year when I met with AV, he told me, like, son, you're not good enough right now. Like, you'll need to really put in the work this summer. So you'd, and that honesty, it was blunt. It might not have been what I wanted to hear after my second year in the NHL, but he was right, and I needed to buckle down and get back to work because I was far from being on the right track to be an NHL player. So I really appreciated that honesty. Torts, man, he was so good to us too. Like, he really helped us make us understand that it was okay, like, to push our physical and mental limits so we could like reach our full potential. And that was like, for me, 1 year that I suffered injuries, broke my foot, broke my jaw, broke my thumb that year. So it's tough to really gain some traction with Torts, but I really enjoyed my time with him. And even for Willie, Willie was really good for me when he always found a positive side in every situation, and I learned that from him. And that was a rebuilding years. It was tough for me. I could see my career that was trending towards the end, and we were kind of rebuilding as an organization. I totally understood, and he gave me the freedom to share my experiences, share my story, share my teaching with the young guys, and they were all good to me. And obviously nowadays I think the new generation, they want it talk more, they want to know where they stand a little bit more. So we make sure in Laval that we talk to these guys on a daily basis, and if they have whatever issues, it could be personal stuff, it could be hockey related questions, it could be something that's on their mind, our office is always open, or our phones are always on 24/7, and we want to work with them, we want to make them achieve their goals, and they all want to play in the NHL. And if they have any issues and they don't feel comfortable and they want to talk about it, they know our door is always open. And that's our message to our group or our team in Laval, where in my days, like, no news, good news was a good thing. If the coach wasn't talking to me for 2 weeks, I knew I was doing a good job, or I knew there wasn't any issues. Where nowadays I feel like we talk to them every day, and it's okay too. Like, they get so much information fired at them from left and right, from social media to their agents, to the information travels so quick to them. So if there's any issues, we talk to them, and they know where we stand.
Honesty and communication. Well, you know where you stand in this fan base. You're going to see a lot of it tonight. Enjoy the night. I know it's hard to take it all in, but do your best.
Thank
because
you.
This community, this arena, the text messages are pouring in right now, Alex. They want to embrace you tonight.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time, buddy.
Awesome, man.
That's Alex Burrows, who goes into the Ring of Honor with the Vancouver Canucks tonight. As you heard at the tail end of that interview, he is now an assistant coach with the Laval Rocket, and it is a lot different. It is about communication. You heard what he said about Alain Vigneault there. The honesty he provided me, I needed that. I needed to know where I stand. I needed to know where I stood at that time. I wouldn't have become what I did had he not been honest with me. And I think he highlighted, even at the tail end of that interview, just how much things are changing. Hey, it used to be, if I didn't hear from the coach for 2 weeks, that was good news. That meant there was no issue with me going on, and I was good with that. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. It's not like that anymore. And as Alex Burrows intimated at the end of the interview, that's not a bad thing. It's not bad to have that open communication, straightforward lines, the coach's door being open. You got something personal you want to talk about? Let's talk about it. Let's see where you're at right now. Let's see if I can help. Longest 2 minutes, worst 2 minutes of his life, he said, sitting in the penalty box in Game 7 overtime. I can only imagine. I can only imagine. None of us will likely ever be in that situation. If you're a very young listener, I hope you are someday. I hope you get to the National Hockey League if that's your dream, and I hope you get in that situation that Alex Burrows was talking about. Game 7 overtime. Scored one of the most famous goals, in many people's opinion, the most famous goal in Vancouver Canucks history. And they'll relive that tonight at Rogers Arena. Guy who never thought he was going to be drafted. Not at all. As he said, hey, man, I got to the American Hockey League, Manitoba Moose. I was making $45,000 a year. I was thinking, this is pretty good living. Playing professional hockey, making 45 G's. If that's where we're at, so be it. As much as we as fans hated that lockout in 2004-2005, there were certain guys, their timing was perfect, and Burrows was one of those guys. There were certain guys that got put into that environment at the time in the American Hockey League, and their careers benefited exponentially from it because of the influx of some NHL talent and because of the environment they were in. Or for younger prospects, they had a chance to develop at that time, and it really propelled their careers forward. Excellent conversation with him. Excellent conversation with you over the last couple of hours. Appreciate the text messages that are coming in. We'll do it again tomorrow. Right now, we'll send you to Hockey Central in Calgary. Here in Vancouver, it's a Canucks game day. Expect to talk to the protege of Alex Burrows, Antoine Roussel, as he's expected to play tonight for the Vancouver Canucks. You've got it on the Scott Rintoul Show.
This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw. First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
Elias comes and it shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
Busy day here in Vancouver. Canucks hosting the Ottawa Senators. Canucks will try to get back on track. Lost that game to the Edmonton Oilers on Sunday night to kick off this five-game homestand. Ottawa presents an excellent opportunity to grab another W for the Vancouver Canucks, but it's Alex Burrows' night here at Rogers Arena. That's where I am stationed, hoping to talk to a member of the Vancouver Canucks here momentarily, trying to figure out whether or not we're getting Antoine Roussel, who looks like he could play tonight. Everyone's expecting him to play tonight. Everyone expecting him to be in the lineup for the first time this season. And does he line up with Adam Gaudette and Josh Levo? That's the odds-on line that he starts with here tonight, but an injection of energy. And somewhat fitting that if Antoine Roussel does make his season debut for the Canucks tonight, it comes on Alex Burrows' night. This is a player, and thanks for all of the text messages that have come in on the heels of the Burrows interview or that came in while we were doing it. There's so many things we could have asked him about. He's a very well-spoken person, and he has such an incredible story. And there are so many aspects you could touch on, and one of them is Antoine Roussel. This is a player who is bouncing around hockey, and if we get him in here, into this room that I'm stationed in down here at Rogers Arena, and we do the interview, I will ask him about the relationship with Alex Burrows, because this is a guy who was bouncing around hockey a little bit, and because he's from the Montreal area, at least that's where he grew up after he left France, came to Canada, he got an opportunity to skate with some NHL guys. Those of you know who know anything about what NHL players do in the summer, they get these skates together. They want to skate with local players in the area, and sometimes they get guys who are junior players or AHL players, whatever it happens to be, so they can get more guys out for the skate. Antoine Roussel got into one with some NHL guys. Burrows was one of them, and the two hit it off. He kind of took him under his wing, and it's not surprising. There is a similarity in style between these two guys. So I'm interested to know why that relationship was established from the get-go, why Roussel saw Burrows as a particular type of mentor for him, and how much he tries to emulate exactly what Alex Burrows did when he has had success here in the NHL, and how much offensive game he thinks. I think people in Vancouver found out just how much more there was to Antoine Roussel last season than certainly they thought coming in. He's one of those shift disturbers, if you will. Got to enunciate on that one. Can be taken the wrong way. We all knew that component to his game, but people found out that he was a better creator, had better vision than people thought. Yeah, he's going to crash and bang and go to the net, all of those things, but we saw how effective he was with a Bo Horvat. As mentioned, expected to go into the lineup beside Adam Gaudette tonight and make his season debut. Ottawa Senators come to town. Good story attached to them, and it's not necessarily standings related. There was a massive scrum down here this morning for Mark Borjecki because of what happened yesterday. Apparently, he foiled an attempted robbery. This story has made its way around social media. You've probably heard it a little bit by now. But apparently, he sees a guy in Gastown break into a car, and he clotheslines him as the thief or would-be thief is trying to get away on the bike. Borjecki had to take the bag that this guy was trying to steal down to the police station. Apparently, it had people's passports in it and stuff like that. So he foils the robbery. Now there's a whole bunch of news people here. They want to talk to him. Local hero, done good. I know Perry Selkowski this morning on the starting lineup was championing some type of moment for him at Rogers Arena, that he had that feel-good moment. Senators, a lot of goodwill here. A lot of goodwill because of that, and because one of the things they did yesterday, and this doesn't make them a good hockey team, but it certainly makes you feel better about the team you're supporting if you're a Senators fan and you don't have a whole lot of wins to cheer about. Yesterday they had some extra food left over after their skate, so they suggested, you know what we should do? We should box it up. We should take it out to the local community. So some members of the media and some members of the Senators decided to do that, and they went out and gave some people in need some food yesterday. That doesn't mean you should hope they win tonight. That doesn't mean you should change your allegiance if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan, but just a couple of the stories that are percolating down here at Rogers Arena. Canucks come into this game tonight, fifth in the Pacific Division, 7 points back of Edmonton, who they saw for a double dip on the weekend. Vegas leapfrogged Vancouver last night, picking up a 4-1 win on the road in New York. Canucks have an opportunity to match that this evening and jump back up in the standings. It'll be a busy night on ice, and we'll see if the Canucks get any energy from Alex Burrows' night here at Rogers Arena, if they get energy simply from Antoine Roussel being in the lineup. It does feel like that point of the season where they could use a little bit of this. We're not into the dog days. Those happen sometime in February, usually, maybe a part of January, where every game just kind of bleeds into the next, and you can kind of see it in the way a team plays. We're not there yet, but after a tough month in November and a start to December that wasn't the ideal one, they lose their first game of this month to the Edmonton Oilers. Yeah, a little spark. They could use that. Canucks could use that here tonight. It'll be Thatcher Demko. As you know, Jacob Markstrom has been excused from the team for a personal absence. He's going to his father's memorial back overseas. Not sure when he'll be back with the team, but the net is Demko's tonight. Mikey DiPietro will be backing up Thatcher Demko here for the Vancouver Canucks. Hit us up on the Subway text message inbox. You've got the number 650-650 if you want in on the conversation. A conversation that does include the Seattle Seahawks. That was the story of the night last night. Seahawks vaulting to number 2 in the NFC, beating the Minnesota Vikings, and doing so in only the way the Seahawks could. Let's hear from Pete Carroll. It's a quick clip, but this sums up the way Pete Carroll likes to play his football in Seattle.
Close games are cool, aren't they? Yeah. I don't know. I like them. Maybe the 17 points was too much. I don't know. We shouldn't have been hit by that much. I don't know.
He's joking, but he's kind of not. He's kind of not. That's the way Seahawks love to play. And hats off to them because they usually win those games. They like to be close. 17 points, we don't really want to be up by that much. They didn't blow their defensive coverage on Laquon Treadwell just so they could make that game close. But as Bick Nizar, who will join me for Canucks Central in less than an hour here at Rogers Arena, likes to say, every Seahawks game is different, but every Seahawks game is the same. And this is a common thread. There are two things they believe they can do, and one of those certainly bared out last night, and usually it's the second one that does it. But last night, here's what they believe they will do. They believe they'll wear you down over four quarters. And last night, with all of the exploits of Russell Wilson this season, a nice touchdown pass to David Moore last night, but with all of his exploits, that's the way Pete Carroll wants to win. He wants to have over 200 yards rushing. He wants the two-headed backfield of Chris Carson and Rashad Penny and take the pressure off Russell, who he knows can perform in the big moment. That's how he loves to play. He doesn't like giving up 30 points. Should have been 31 if Dan Bailey didn't miss that extra point. He doesn't want to give up that much, but he wants to do it on the ground. That's how Pete Carroll would like to go about his business. They play on slim margins every single week because, one, they believe they'll wear you down over four quarters, which they did last night to that Minnesota run defense, and two, Russell Wilson will make plays when he has to. Didn't need him to do it big time last night. Didn't find themselves in that situation because of the massive third quarter they had, because of a couple of turnovers that really swung this game. Dalvin Cook going out certainly changed the offensive look of the Minnesota Vikings. So they didn't have to call on Russell Wilson. They do. You know how it's going to go. He's going to show up, and generally he's going to do what Kirk Cousins could not do last night. Kirk Cousins didn't lose that game for the Minnesota Vikings. Kirk Cousins didn't fumble the ball. Kirk Cousins threw a good pass to Stephon Diggs. It wasn't his fault that Diggs didn't catch it, and it bounced up into the hands of a waiting Seahawk DB who picked off the pass, and the Seahawks scored a touchdown moments later in that ensuing series. That's not on Kirk Cousins. Cousins didn't lose them the game, but he didn't win them the game. And this has always been people's problem with Kirk Cousins. When he's put in the situation he was last night in the fourth quarter, down by four, ball in your hands, less than 5 minutes to play, he doesn't get over. And there's a lot of reasons for it. Yeah, he doesn't have Dalvin Cook available. Adam Thielen still not back in the lineup, one of his most trusted receivers. Diggs was having a little bit of an off night, dropped a couple of passes in that game. But the guy on the other side, his counterpart, guy he played against in the Big Ten, they talked about that last night in the broadcast, when Russell Wilson's put in that situation, he generally wins. He finds a way to win his team the game. And Kirk Cousins, for all of the good things he does, he generally doesn't find a way to win his team the game. And that's because he's just not that tier of quarterback. I think we've come to accept that. That does not mean he's incapable of winning. It doesn't mean Minnesota can't win with him. What it means is you better have other pieces around in place. Russell Wilson loses his security blanket down in San Francisco in overtime, and so he fires up Josh Gordon for the first time ever in Seahawks colors. He hits Malik Turner. Who, you say? Yeah, Malik Turner. Probably not on a lot of fantasy rosters. He finds a way to get the most out of those guys around him because he's the best player on the field at those times. Kirk Cousins can't make the same claim. You can still win with Kirk Cousins, but you're going to have to put more pieces in place. With Russell Wilson, he's the piece you need. And this is part of the design of the Seattle Seahawks that makes it tough for their fans, frustrating for their fans, hair-pulling, fingernail-biting time for their fans, but is also a part of their success. They've put themselves in those situations so many times that it's commonplace. It doesn't always work out, and it's tough to live on that margin. And the Seahawks have done it better this year than they have in previous editions because there are flaws to this team. There are ways to beat the Seattle Seahawks, but it's only happened twice this year because they're 9-1 in one-score games. They almost never run away with it. Did it once against Arizona in week four, and that's it. But win the toss in overtime against the Bucs, go down, score a touchdown, ball game. Greg Zuerlein doesn't hit his kick. Win the ball game. Get a big play right at the end of a game against the Cincinnati Bengals in week one. Win the ball game. That's kind of the way it goes for the Seattle Seahawks, but they've been living on that margin a lot this year, even more than in previous editions. Four games to go. They have control of the division. This is going to come down to the wire. This game this coming weekend against the LA Rams, not easy. Not an easy one by any stretch, despite what you may think of the Rams this year relative to what you thought about them before. Keep the text messages coming in. We get them. Want to get into a conversation with you here on the Scott Rentola Show. Alex Burrows. I know we're not going to have a chance to play this later in this hour because things are getting backlogged. We're going to get a Canuck here soon. We're going to hear from Travis Green once he takes to the podium here. So let's hear from Alex Burrows. If you missed this interview last hour, Game 7 is what he is most notably remembered for. And the prominent role he played in that game. It wasn't just the goal at the end. It was all of the other stuff, including taking a two-minute penalty in overtime and having to sit there with his team's season on the line against that team, the Chicago Blackhawks, who had ended their playoff dreams in each of the two previous campaigns. What was that like? Here's Alex Burrows.
For me, that game was the craziest game of my career. Like you mentioned, I scored the first goal. Great setup by Ryan Kessler. And then in the third period, I don't know if you remember, but I missed a penalty shot. I got tripped on a breakaway, and I got a penalty shot, and I made the worst move that I've ever done in my career in a penalty shot. I didn't change my speed, didn't change my angle. That terrible shot, like, it was the worst penalty shot ever. And even then, they got a power play late in the game, and they scored on the PK with, like, a minute left, and I was kind of involved in that situation where I feel I could have maybe prevented that goal or... So that was another bad play. Then a penalty that was the worst 2 minutes of my life, sitting with a lazy hooking penalty in the offensive zone in overtime, like terrible penalty. And but I knew that my guys could pull it off for me. Everybody wanted to win so bad, so I knew they could pull it off. And we had pre-scouted them. Like now it's game seven, so we know what they're trying to do in their power play. And I still remember we talked about that goal line play, and Lou read it perfectly. And obviously, I would have liked Kevin to cut that pass, but Taze made that pass to Patrick Sharp, and Lou made that unbelievable shoulder save. And I think, like, everybody talks about the goal and slaying the dragon, but that save is why we kept playing and why I had an opportunity to score the game winner. So I'll forever remember that save for Lou for saving my in the penalty box at that time. And who knows what the story would be different for sure if that goal would have gone in. I got a chance to score that big goal afterwards.
What a wild game. Scores the first goal, has a penalty shot in the third period, takes a penalty in overtime only to score the game-winning goal, the Slay the Dragon goal. One of so many emotional goals that Alex Burrows is remembered for. It's easy to forget he scored a series-clinching overtime goal against the St. Louis Blues in a previous playoff run for the Vancouver Canucks. It's easy to forget the time they had lost, was it 8 or 9 consecutive games at home, and Burrows scores the shorthanded goal against the Carolina Hurricanes and emulates breaking the stick across his knee. The goals he scored shortly after Luc Bourdon's unfortunate passing, and he would shoot the arrow to the sky in honor of Luc Bourdon. There were just so many emotional moments like that with Alex Burrows, and there were emotional moments that drew large waves of criticism around the hockey world. Lots of them, whether they were interactions with other players on the ice, some of which he has since apologized for, that have come to light, whether they were the incident with Stéphane Auger. But one of the things he talked about in the interview, and I will retweet it for you as soon as I have it posted here, as soon as I can get it to you, I'll get it out there. One of the things that Alex Burrows knew he always had, and he said this in the interview, whether it was good times or bad times, he knew the market had his back. He knew the fans had his back. Didn't make him a perfect hockey player. Didn't make him a perfect person on the ice. But there was this emotional connection. And it's one he forged with a number of players. Luc Bourdon was one of them. We talked about that. We talked about the relationship he had as well with Rick Rypien. And my next guest, he has a relationship with him as well, but he was always able to make that emotional connection, and that's part of the reason Alex Burrows is so beloved in this community. Antoine Roussel knows that. He now has the Alex Burrows role on this team to a certain degree, and he joins me at Rogers Arena. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. You're smiling bigger than I've seen you this year because you know you get to get back on the ice tonight, don't you?
I'm so excited. And it's been a big target on my calendar to just come back on this night. I was hoping to come earlier, but that was my last resort, like, to come back. So I'm pretty pumped about it.
How difficult was it being patient?
It was for sure. I kept myself busy for a reason, so that way I don't have too much time to kill, and that way I stayed busy and I barely see the time flew. So it's been a long road. I worked hard on my game, on my physicality, and it's just a good time. I felt like the hard work starts a bit now too, like just coming back and having like a couple good games, and it's gonna be a little bit of time since I kind of feel my groove back, but I can't wait to get going.
You got out there on the ice with Utica over the weekend. How did that feel?
Pretty good. It's good to play a couple games. Felt like a mini training camp to me. Just get there, like, play some games. The guys out there were really nice to me, and it just felt good. First game was hard. Second game better, and I'm hoping that third game tonight is going to be even better.
Antoine Roussel gets back into the lineup for the Canucks tonight. He joins me here at Rogers Arena. You've been watching this team as you've been trying to get back. What do you think this team needs a little bit of right now?
Just energy. I mean, like, we've been playing so many games in a short period of time. This team's been on the road for 2 weeks, and people don't realize how much it takes out of your body just traveling so much, missing your family and everything. So just coming back and maybe, like, just have a little spark. And this team is a really good team, and I'm excited to help.
So what role do you think you filled this year, maybe as opposed to the one you filled last year?
Same role. I mean, like, there's no change for me. It's always been the same role over and over every year, and I just have to bring it, and we'll take it from there.
Well, you say it's the same role, but we know you're an energy guy. We know you're a physical guy. We know you're going to get under people's skins, but I think last year Canucks fans had a greater appreciation for the offensive talent you have as well. Do you think that's something you bring to the table again this season in the role you're going to be employed right now?
Oh, for sure. Like, I don't think, like, my mentality over that changed. Like, I always try to bring my offense. That's what keeps me in the league, keeps me, like, playing on a good line. If, like, I don't bring that, I'll lose the spot. So, like, for me, it's always been a focus over the years to just bring like offense and everything in my game. Sometimes, like, it's not as I want to, but I just have to work through it. And like I said, I'm so excited for tonight.
Well, I think a lot of Canucks fans are as well. Not just do they get you back in the lineup, it's fitting to me that you go back in on Alex Burrows' night because he's been a mentor to you. How did that relationship develop?
Well, we one summer back in Quebec, like about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more, I changed my my training in the summer, and I went to see that guy who had Alex Burrows, Daniel Zubrus, Pascal Dupuis, Jean-Sébastien Giguère, and I said I want to train with the best, and so he took my word for it and, like, put me with those guys. And right off the gate, Alex was really nice to me, like, talking to me. One summer we were, like, really thinking, like, how I can get my shot better. And one day he just showed up with a shooter tutor and just gave me a $500 gift to a kid he barely knew. And that's the kind of gesture and the man he was. He's just, like, took it too hard to, like, pass along what maybe somebody else gave it to him back in the day. So he's been really nice to me.
Did you know his story before you met him? Did you know that he was a guy who was undrafted, went to the ECHL, made his way to the NHL, and eventually played on the top line here?
Right away, no. Like, obviously somebody told me, and then I looked up to it, and for sure then the connection even got better.
Did you see similarities in his game and your game and say, you know what, I can do the exact same thing?
For sure. Obviously, when I started and I started paying more attention, Alex was already a 36-goal scorer for the Canucks. So that's not something I was really looking up right away, is my offensive game, but, like, all the rest, for sure.
We were joking with him off the air about you chirping him in the ads as well last year on our station, having fun with him and your Passat Motors ads.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I didn't think he would hear it back home in Montreal, so I took advantage of it. But obviously somebody sent the link, so I got to watch for my back now.
Antoine Roussel joining me here. He goes back into the lineup tonight at Rogers Arena. Canucks looking to get back on track here in early December. JT Miller, we were talking about this yesterday. To me, he's been this team's best player this year. What do you think he's brought to the table?
Well, he's an all-around player. He's a good leader, good playmaker, hard worker, hard-nosed guys. All those guys, like those marks, he checks. And he's been really good with Bess and Petey. Just get them more involved in the game, get them more physical. And even I felt like Brock has been really good this year with like his physicality. He goes in the corner, plays really hard. And I think that starts with JT Miller being around and just maybe talk to him much. And because that's one thing, if I tell him to do that, and like if there's another thing, if JT Miller, most established first-round guy, does it. So it's been really good, great addition, and what a play he made last night, like the other night. I was like on the press box, and I loved it. I didn't see it right after the game, but I told him this morning I love the play. I want to do that every night, but I can't sometimes.
The edge work and just leaning into guys, buying time in the zone. It was a fantastic play, and that's just offensive instinct that he has. You mentioned he's a former first-round pick. You've done what he had to do. You went from one organization to the other, a new group of guys. Is it easy to fit in right away? What makes that transition more comfortable?
Well, I always feel like it's a personality. Like if you're like a go around guys, you just like talk to everybody, and like you're not scared to put yourself out there, like then you'll be easy and fast, and that's what we have in common, I think.
And you decided that you'd keep the mustache for this month. How
yeah.
come?
Well, I said I'd come back in November, so it's in a way of saying I'm coming back the 31st November.
There you go. I like it. Are you going to keep it all month?
Well, I don't know. We'll see.
That's usually not your decision. That's usually, you know, the wife's decision.
Well, I don't know. Somebody say if I score tonight, I might have to keep it all year, so we'll see.
Well, Canucks fans would love that. Antoine, good luck. Have fun tonight. I know you've been waiting for this for a long time.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. That's Antoine Roussel joining us here. Tableside at Rogers Arena. Travis Green is next right here on your home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Game night for the Vancouver Canucks. Ottawa Senators in town. As or more importantly, Alex Burrows night, as this community gets to see Alex Burrows' name added to the Ring of Honor, becomes the seventh member of that group that has been feated, and he will get that honor tonight at Rogers Arena. It'll be a packed house. It'll be a jumping crowd tonight. And that's good news for a team that could use a little bit of jump, and a team that will get Antoine Roussel back into the lineup tonight. An Alex Burrows type of player for this year's edition of a Canucks team that needs to make something happen on this homestand. The road trip was what it was. 3-3, the homestand, even though it felt like the last game of a 7-game road trip as opposed to the first game of a 5-game homestand, they were okay. Better team for 40 minutes. Didn't have enough jump in the legs to finish that game off. Got stung by McDavid and Draisaitl, and that was that. So they need to get something going. They've got Ottawa tonight. They've got Buffalo on Saturday. Then it's the Leafs. Then it's the Hurricanes, a couple of games on the road, and then it's right back home. This is a comfortable month in terms of travel. And if you're going to complain about the rigors of the schedule when you play as many road games as they did last month, then you got to take care of your own business at home. When the getting's good, go take care of your business. It's as simple as that. Otherwise, don't talk to me about how difficult the road schedule is. When things are good, when you're getting on a back-to-back. And the Canucks were living that way in October, and they made the most of it. Can they do so again this month? Antoine Roussel will most certainly help that. We'll hear from Travis Green here in just a couple of moments. I'm live at Rogers Arena. Bick Nazar will join me for Canucks Central in a half an hour's time. Yannick Hansen will sit in with us, a former teammate of Alex Burrows, and we'll get his take on what he sees from this current edition of the Canucks as well. Burrows joined me an hour ago. We had so much to talk about, and thank you all for your questions, your ideas. I wish I could get them all in. We just don't have enough time. There's so many things we could touch on with Burrows, and one of them was coaching. This is a guy who had a lot of different coaches at a lot of different levels as he made his way up to the NHL ranks, and he's coaching now, so he sees the other side of it. And as you all know, the last 10 days, 12 days, 2 weeks, whatever it's been exactly, it's been pretty tenuous in the coaching world and in hockey in general, talking about the relationship between coaches and players. So I ended the interview by asking Alex Burrows about the coaches who've had a positive impact on his career, or if there's one that stands out. Here's what he had to say.
Obviously, nowadays, I think the new generation, they want to talk more. They want to know where they stand a little bit more. So we make sure in Laval that we talk to these guys on a daily basis. And if they have whatever issues, it could be personal stuff, it could be hockey-related questions, it could be something that's on their mind, our office is always open, or our phones are always on 24/7, and we want to work with them. We want to make them achieve their goals, and they all want to play in the NHL. And if they have any issues and they don't feel comfortable and they want to talk about it, they know our door is always open. And that's our message to our group or our team in Laval, where in my days, like, no news, good news was a good thing. If the coach wasn't talking to me for 2 weeks, I knew I was doing a good job, or I knew there wasn't any issues. Where nowadays, I feel like we talk to them every day, and it's okay too. Like, they get so much information fired at them from left and right, from social media to their agents, to the information travels so quick to them. So if there's any issues, we talk to them, and they know where we stand.
Got my signals crossed a little there. Before he got on to that answer, he had talked about the influence of Alain Vigneault and John Tortorella, and even talked about Willie Desjardins as he went through the course of his career. But yeah, Alex Burrow's talking about where coaching's at right now, where communication's at right now. It's a very thoughtful and expansive answer. Once we have the full interview posted, I will tweet it out for you. I will send a link to the post as well so you can listen to the whole interview. It's really good stuff with Alex Burrows. You're going to hear a lot of talk about him today. The other team he played for, of course, the Ottawa Senators. A team that comes into town with not a lot in terms of expectations, not a lot on that roster overall. But as Bick and I talked about last week on Canucks Central, a team that's been oddly interesting. And that odd interest continued yesterday off the ice. Mark Borjecki had a great story that everybody in Vancouver can get on board with. Everybody embraces this story. They want to make him a community champion after hearing this yesterday. He thwarted a robbery in Gastown during the Senators' visit here. He detailed it for the masses this morning here at Rogers Arena.
Okay, so I went to lunch at Miku with Mikel and Dylan, and they wanted to go to do a little shopping in Gastown, so we did that, and I split off to go to Parade Organics baby store. Shout out to that store. Cool. So I was walking back in Gastown and had my baby stuff in my right hand and saw this suspicious guy just kind of like shuffling down the sidewalk, and he had a bike with him, so I found it kind of strange. He was just like shuffling around with his bike, and I'm just like looking over at him. I just hear this huge, well, see him and hear this huge bang, and I just hear this like blue Chevy fall out of the passenger side window, just shatters. And I like look over and kind of yelled like, "Hey!" And then I see him like wrestling this big hiking backpack out of the front, can't quite get it out. And I yelled at him from across the street, and I was like, "Put the bag down, bro." And he was like yelling and swearing at me, telling me to go away and stuff. You know, I started trotting across the street, and I was like, "Dude, like, put the bag down." Yelled at me again, swearing at me again, telling me to F off and go away. And at this point, I started running towards him because I knew he was going to take the bag. So I was like, "All right, dude, last chance, put the bag down." And again, he said the same things to me over and over. So I started running towards him, and he got on his bike, threw the bag on, and he took like, I don't know, like five or like three hard pedals towards me, thinking, I don't know if he thought he was just going to ram me or if I was going to jump out of the way. I had my baby stuff in my right hand, so with my left arm, I just kind of like reflexively, like, I'll clear the air. I didn't like, you know, my first thought was, if I absolutely destroy this guy and he gets hurt, like, what are the legal ramifications for me here? Because I could have done some damage. So I was like, try to do this as gently as I can. So I just like kind of hooked my left arm and sort of like under his arm and like pulled him off the bike to the ground. And like, that was the same arm that had the bag. So I had like his arm and the bag on my left arm, I think. And he was like down, kind of like trying to get away from me, swearing at me. And I was just ready, like kind of like waiting. If he pulled something sharp, I was going to drop my baby supplies and crack him one. But he just kind of like got his bike and went away. And again, I didn't really know like what the rules of engagement, so to speak, were, like whether I could pin him down or, you know, like how hard I could hit him. So I was like, I'm just going to make sure I don't like physically hurt this guy, but get the bag back. And the cops kind of had a good chuckle about that with me after. And I called them and just waited by the car because there was a bunch of snowboards in there and other stuff. And the cops were like, yeah, you know, took my statement and said they'd try to contact whoever it was. So they opened the bag up, and first thing they found was a couple of passports. So right place at the right time.
Borrow cop. Sign him up. Dude's got a job already. Forget about the hockey. Come here. Patrol this community. We want it. It's been a good couple of weeks for him. Really good couple of weeks. That's a great random act of kindness and being a citizen on patrol and just doing the right thing. Awesome. And I can only imagine in that moment going through what he's going through. Okay, I don't want to hurt the guy here. And also, I don't want to endanger myself, but I'm trying to do the right thing. It all worked out. Good for him. Great stuff. But this is a guy who had a lot of thoughtful comments in the last week or so about this coaching situation and about where we're at in today's world of player-coach interaction and how it needs to improve. He was in a tough spot last year. What did you know him for mostly because of this? Because he was in the video with Eugene Melnyk. He was the guy who was in between two sends. Yeah, you knew he played, and you knew he was a tough customer, played the game the honest way, all of those things. But he was in the video with Eugene Melnyk last year. The fact that we haven't heard any of that is a very, very good thing, not only for the players on this team, but for that organization. Eugene Melnyk's been quiet. That's great. Whoever convinced him to do that, bonus them up this holiday season. I've lived through something similar down in with the San Francisco 49ers. Jed York would talk, and he would leak information, and it always turned out badly, and he developed a bad reputation. There is a correlation between hiring some people to do a job and then letting them do their job and just not being the guy who has to answer all the questions all the time. That's happened with the 49ers. I'm not telling you the Senators are going to make a run to the playoffs next season necessarily, but it just makes it a better environment to work in for that club. Borowiecki, great story. There were news cameras down here. Everybody wanted a piece of that one when it got out yesterday on social media. Apparently, according to Dan Murphy, who was one of the first to report the stories, he hadn't said that on camera yesterday, hadn't said it on any microphones, just kind of threw it at them as he was heading out the door, and there were only about four of them who heard it, so they caught wind of it. And obviously today the reporters wanted to get their hooks into that one. Good story. Getting the text messages all right already. People saying, love this story. Such a nice change of pace from NHL. Sounds like a solid guy. Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And yet Canucks fans, I hope he's on the losing end tonight. It's Alex Burrow's night here at Rogers Arena. He goes into the Ring of Honor, joins six other players who are up there already. One of them, an administrator as well, in Pat Quinn, who is up there posthumously here at Rogers Arena. We're getting the Travis Green audio for you. We want to turn it around. How close are we, Jamie? We got that yet? We do not have that yet. So we'll continue to tee you up for this game tonight. Canucks, as mentioned, trying to get things started. Second game of a five-game homestand. And now they get a break. Take care of this one tonight. You get the extra energy in the building, not only because of Burrows, but you get Antoine Roussel back in the lineup. And then you get to rest until Saturday. You get to put your feet up for a couple of days. Get to start to get the legs back that, let's face it, at the end of the road trip, Sunday night, third period against the Oilers, just didn't have what they had had earlier in the road trip. Just didn't have that same jump. Well, you get it tonight, and you get the guy who's going to go out there, and he's going to throw his weight around a little bit. I sat with Antoine Roussel 15, 20 minutes ago, and he was grinning like a Cheshire cat. He is so excited to get back into this lineup. And he's not going to get back in on the line that he had hoped to. When we sat down with him at the Sports Celebrities Festival, you know who he wants to play with? He wants to play on a line with Michael Ferland. Canucks fans would just like to see a healthy Michael Ferland. I'm sure he hopes the same thing. But those two guys, he wants to be on a line with them. He thinks that it can rub off on each other and they can be kind of one of those wrecking ball lines that has some offensive upside as well. It's not going to be with that. Looks like he'll start tonight with Adam Gaudette and Josh Levo. But that is a very welcome presence. We've talked about what JT Miller has done for this club this year. I've got him as their best player to this point in time. Obviously plays the game a little bit differently. He's a more highly skilled version of a guy like Antoine Roussel. But some of it's just being strong on pucks, winning board battles, experience, all of those things that Roussel adds to the lineup. Miller has components of those. He's willing to do the hard work. Antoine Roussel is going to do the exact same thing for this team. Again, you're not getting the point production. You're not getting the elite skill that JT Miller brings to the table. You're not going to see Antoine Roussel in the first unit power play, but that's what he brings to the table. Can they feed off that tonight? Can they feed off the energy of this crowd? It's going to be loud in here. Been a lot of text messages from people saying that Alex Burrow's favorite player. This one comes in from Torgy and Langley. I'm smiling the whole time. Burr is my all-time favorite Canuck. He played the game with so much passion and heart. Can't wait for tonight. Congrats, Alex. Okanagan Jay. My son was born May 24, 2011. He's named Mason Alexander after Mason Raymond and Alexander Burrows. Yeah, he's one of those guys. One of those guys. There's a bunch of Lindens running around. I'll bet there's a bunch of Alexes. I'm not sure people named their kid Burrow or Burrows in honor of him. But Alex, yeah, I can see that. As we wait for the Travis Green audio, taking your texts as well. Bick smiling here because his Seahawks won last night and he felt very good about it, but he knows that it happened in the same kind of fashion that every Seahawks game happens. Sounds like Jake Virtanen is going to be a game-time decision tonight. We'll wait to hear Travis Green actually give us the word on that. But it sounds as though he's suffering from the flu a little bit. So the second we get that audio, we'll turn it around. But we're going to have to wait. We're going to have to wait to hear it from Travis Green himself. Throw on your headset there for a second, Bick. I want your read on the Seahawks game last night as we wait to get the Travis Green audio on the air. You say this all the time. You say every Seahawks game is different, but every Seahawks game is the same. Did that one qualify in the same capacity last night?
Oh, of course.
Here, take this one. Oh, you got it now?
Yes, of course. That was like the pick six. That was peak Seahawks. You throw a batted pass, and yes, I understand players kind of taught to try to spike the ball down. That was not a spike from Russell Wilson. That was a set right back to the defense. And look, it's... You would think, be like, ah, oh, what a frustrating play. But when it happens every week, you kind of have to embrace the madness, embrace the weirdness when it comes with the Seahawks.
Carroll loves it.
Yeah.
He likes to live there. And part of the reason he likes to live there, and it served the franchise well, is that he feels like close games prepare his team for playoff games, for championship games. It's a championship week every week in Seattle. They've lived that margin more this season than I think in previous campaigns. I can't remember them living it week in, week out as much as they have. 10 of 12 games this year have been decided by a score or less.
And they're 9-1 in those games. And one of the indicators from year-to-year success is how one-score games flip. So, yeah, you can enjoy the success next year. I guarantee you, though, coming into next year, every article, everything's going to point to here's a big regression candidate because one-score games, unless you're Tom Brady or unless you're Peyton Manning, aren't really sustainable. Now, that leads to a bigger question. Well, Russell Wilson's pretty good. It just, like, you can't live like this over year to year to year to year. The other thing you can do is, well, just don't play one-score games. But that doesn't fit Pete Carroll's motto. All those missed kicks and last-second field goals that they do hit generally don't stay consistent year to year. But enjoy it in the now.
Exactly. And they got the win last night. And, hey, they did last night what they generally do. They found a way. And it was a different way last night, even though it kind of feels like the same way. I feel like they're a regression candidate at some point here in the last 4 weeks of the season. Not to fall on their face completely, and they're not going to lose three of their last four. I'm not suggesting that whatsoever. But you live on that margin that long, one or two of these games bound to go the other way.
You hopefully don't see it happen in the playoffs.
Well, and listen, yeah. I said this early in the show. If I'm a Seahawks fan, I almost hope it does happen in the next 4 weeks because they're due for one of those, aren't they?
Well, the thing is, like, they want home field. Last night's game, though, I know it's a one-score game.
Last night's different because they're up by 17.
They were up by so much, and it never really felt in doubt because they had a lead at times, and it was really just that pick six that kind of brought them back into it and just the big touchdown. It was almost the mistakes leading to bigger plays. But in general, no, I mean, it's tough because we know there's – it breaks all the math, and that's what is so frustrating at times to watch games at times, to say, just go win by a bigger margin and we don't have to worry about the numbers suggesting, oh, there's a regression coming. In the immediate, look, I don't know if there is one coming. It's the Rams, the Panthers, and the Cardinals. The Rams are probably the toughest test in there, but the Panthers are slowly falling apart. The Cardinals, they're improving, but it feels like they've plateaued for what they can do this season. And then it's all going to come down to Week 17.
Do you feel it so it's going to be within a game come Week 17?
That would be a lot of fun.
Niners have a tough schedule.
The Niners have a tough schedule, especially this week, right? If they
on the road
stumble,
against New Orleans.
Yeah, if they stumble this week against the Saints, then suddenly it's a bit of a clearer picture. But there's still that separation. I know both teams can go 3-1. It depends which loss it is. The 49ers could afford to lose this week so long as they win Week 17 and still win the division, assuming the Seahawks, because they would beat the Seahawks in that Week 17 game.
Yeah, they certainly could do that. The Seahawks, to me, very emblematic of what the NFC is this year. There's lots of good teams, but there's no surefire team to beat.
I think that's just the NFL in general now. It feels like we've been saying that for the past couple of years, that the parity in the league is now slowly squished everybody into the middle. Now, the Patriots still find a way to rise to the top, but it's more about how do you create kind of fake parity for everyone in the league. Now it just winds up being like, here we are, what is it, week 14 going into that week. You look across the league, well, Green Bay is leading division, and New England is leading division, and, well, Baltimore is leading division, Kansas City, Seattle, it's New Orleans, it's all the same teams doing it over again, because those teams have the most consistent institutions and most consistent quarterbacks, too.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, and Kirk Cousins, to me, last night showed you exactly why people get frustrated with him, but I'm not sure.
He made some big throws, too.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. This is exactly what I'm saying. I'm not sure why people are saying, Kirk Cousins lost. Kirk Cousins didn't lose that game yesterday, and that's kind of the way it's been. He doesn't lose them games. He just doesn't win them games when he's given the ball at the end like a Russell Wilson would. And you want to know why? Because he's not a top-tier quarterback. And if you're not in the top tier, you need more pieces around you. And when you eliminate pieces like Adam Thielen and you eliminate pieces like Dalvin Cook, which they lost last night, Kirk Cousins is generally not a guy who most of the time is going to elevate the guys to the extent he needs to win those games in those moments. It doesn't mean you can't win with him. You just need more pieces in place. Russell Wilson's a guy who, okay, we lost Tyler Lockett. All right, I guess Malik Turner, I'll throw you the ball because Russell Wilson's that good. He doesn't need as many pieces in place. People have viewed Cousins through the wrong lens. They think he's a top-tier quarterback. He's not. Just accept him for what he is and hope that you can push him toward the top of tier two instead of having him in the middle or the bottom half of tier two.
And I think you can be effective in that. Like, you can win Super Bowls.
Of course you can.
With that sort of model. And it's at that point, hey, don't make mistakes. And yesterday I thought, you know, he didn't make mistakes. The interceptions, that's
on Diggs.
Yeah, to me, that's a perfect throw. It's right there. And I know that's A, on Diggs, and then B, that's pretty good coverage too. And you earn that interception. The way that defensive line played yesterday was the big issue, and it didn't give Kirk Cousins opportunities. I think they had 20 minutes of time on attack last night. It's tough to, when you have the ball that little, and part of it is because they have an interception return for a touchdown, but it's tough to try to generate a lot of offense with such little time, and that's one of the models like the New England Patriots used last year against Patrick Mahomes. It's like, we know you can score, but you're only going to get the ball for 20 minutes, and how much can you generate in that time?
We're going to turn our attention back to hockey. Bick, as mentioned, here for Canucks Central. You'll hear from Travis Green on the other side, and Yannick Hansen joining us on Canucks Central, a former teammate of Alex Burrows, now a guy who looks at it through a little different lens as he views this year's version of the Vancouver Canucks. That's all coming up next on your home of hockey, your home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.